Heritage Council meeting to order. We're going to put Scott Wall on the phone here, so just bear with us as we get Scott typed in.
Your call cannot be completed if dialed. Your call cannot be completed.
We will need to have someone.
If you call back. We call him on his cell phone.
That would be great. I've got a phone number here for you. It's 218.
Who's got the phone number?
Okay. You give him a holler, Joe?
Yeah.
Yeah, why don't you do it if you've got Scott's phone number?
I've got his phone number.
360-6027. Yeah. Huh. Hold on, Bill. I'm calling in courageously. Is there a fire volume?
That's a good sign.
Good morning.
Good morning, Scott. Thanks, Mike Kilgore.
Thank you.
Hey, Captain, how you doing?
We're doing good. We're typing in. We're at the meeting. We're just called the meeting to order.
Ready to go.
All right.
Michael, I want to just let them know that everybody can hear him.
Yeah, and so you're on speaker, so we have 7 council members at the table and staff and a number of people in the room as well, and so whatever you say is heard by all.
And what council members, Mike, are not there?
We have the council members that are here, Wes and Bill Lieberson and Wayne, myself, Ellen, Bob, Darby, and then so that would leave Bob Gunther and Jim Cox and
David
Hartwell.
Rick Hansen.
Very good, thank you.
Yep, very good. So, members, hopefully you have a packet of materials before you. We have a business meeting that will last until around 1 o'clock, and then we're going to have a presentation followed by a number of stops on a field tour this afternoon, and by the way, anyone out in the audience is certainly welcome to participate in the field tour as well. When we had our field tour in Alexandria, Fergus Falls last month, we had, I would guess, 35 to 40 people that attended that tour, and so we certainly would encourage you, if you have the time and the inclination, to participate. Remember, the agenda is before you. The only correction that I would suggest is that under item number 5, which is Personnel Committee Report and Action Item, it's not an action item. Our bylaws call for the chair to appoint members to committees other than the executive committee. And so following the report of Bob on the Personnel Committee, we'll just talk about the expansion of the committee, and I can take that action as the chair of the council. Members, are there any other changes, additions, deletions that you see to the agenda as modified? Hearing none. I have a motion. I need a motion to adopt the agenda. You have a motion to adopt the agenda as amended. Further discussion. Hearing none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion adopted. We have the meeting minutes from last month's meeting in Alexandria. Are there any, Bill, did you hear of any corrections, additions, deletions to the meeting minutes that's drafted?
Mike, I have not.
Okay. Mike, there's one very tiny little correction that I think needs to be made on page 2. Under administrative budget update, the last word in that first line, ask council members if the, how about making that fifth day?
So just could you restate that again?
Under the administrative budget update on page 2.
Yep.
First line, it begins with staff. If you go to the end, the word the doesn't do it. You need they, because it references to council, but obviously that's rather interesting.
Got it. All right. Any other changes to the meeting minutes as drafted? Hearing none, I'd entertain a motion to adopt the meeting minutes as modified. We have a motion. Any further discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Meeting minutes are approved. Bill, Executive Director's report.
There are two items I'd like to report on as a result of tasks that were assigned to me at the last meeting. One is to get in touch with the Southwest Initiative Foundation, Ms. Nancy Fashing, and discuss the Green Corridor project with her, specifically the administrative budget. In your packets, you'll find a letter from me to Ms. Fashing that requests additional information on the budget, the administrative budget, and as well asks for some information with regard to the nature of the land that they're buying. We have discovered in the process of discussing this project that the property that they are intending to purchase already has a conservation easement on it, and we've asked for some more information about that. As an update, I'll be scheduling a meeting with Mr. Cobb, Ms. Fashing, myself, and the chair for sometime next week to discuss this work program and anticipate seeing something back in front of the council in the August meeting.
Okay. Any questions for Bill on that item? And so, Bill, just to clarify, the letter can send, you've had some initial conversation, but nothing as a follow-up once the letter was...
That's the other item that people asked me to do was to get a schedule for the rest of the year out, and I prepared a proposed schedule. I think there are enough copies to go down. I generally want to just talk about it in general. What this schedule does is it sets us up for an October 1st call for requests with a November 1st due date, a mid-November selection of proposals, hearing a few proposals at the end of November, and then 2 days of hearings for proposals in December. I would anticipate that this would allow us to do 48 proposals, so if you wanted to spend less time in hearings, you could select less proposals to hear. Then in mid-December, review draft language, in early January, review the final language, and then we don't meet again until May, end of May in 2010. So if you all have reactions to that, I'd like to hear them now, and I can revise and the final schedule out.
Any comments or questions about the schedule?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Bill, just to be clear, from the public standpoint, from the groups that are interested in coming to the council for funding, what do they need to know from a timing standpoint?
They need to know when the call for requests will be available. They need to know the deadline. They need to know when we'll be selecting proposals for hearing, and they need to know when a requested hearing would likely occur.
And Mr. Chair, we'll have the opportunity to put specificity around those particular milestones by the next meeting, you think?
All of those milestones are on here in terms of the hearing dates, November 23rd, December 8th, and December 9th. What we need to add here is the distribution of the call for requests and the deadline for those to come in, which would be October 1st and November 1st. And we'll have that on there.
And so, Bill, when do you anticipate us formalizing our call for proposals or requests or however we term it? At what meeting?
That would be at September 15, 16, strategic planning meeting.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, is it in, I presume, Bill, we'll get an update from management analysis in August on their work to date.
Mm-hmm.
And then is it a, your view that we will have, in effect, a final preliminary report, final draft report, or a draft report, if you will, for September, and that's the nature, the backdrop for the discussion that we will have on the 15th of September?
On the 15th of September, what I would expect us to do is, first of all, finalize the material that the management analysis division brings to us, and then insert that into a larger request, call for requests, which will be prepared and ready for editing at those meetings. So we've got, for lack of a better term, the boilerplate, and then we've got the results of the strategic planning, and those will be our priorities.
So from a public standpoint, Mr. Chair, for those organizations that may want to come to the council for requests, they would probably have an interest in being there in September as well to find out what discussions we had regarding how the strategic plan was, the decisions were made and arrived at, so that they would be then informed for their for the October 1st call for requests, if you will.
That's a good point. So I'll note that on that 15th, 16th of September meeting that we'll be finalizing the call for requests.
Wayne?
Mr. Chair, I know that I'm not going to be available on the 16th, but I would have no objection to having an open-ended adjournment for the 15th if we needed to do the run longer. So.
Bill, assuming that we finalize our call for proposal and we issue that shortly after the 15th or the 16th, what do you anticipate being on the docket for the October meeting?
Right now, the docket's clean except for the Clean Water Council.
Okay.
And October is an important month.
Yeah. I'm just sensitive because I know that as we schedule these meetings, I know that it's a great commitment for people to break away from their business or their home life to come up here. So I think, members, we just need to keep that October 19th meeting on hold, but it may be that we don't need to schedule a meeting in October because once we issue the call, unless there are some work plans that are outstanding that we haven't yet approved, there may not be a need to meet or enough business that we can't take care of once we start meeting in November and reviewing proposals that come in. Any other comments or questions about the schedule?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd like to thank Bill for giving us 6 months out for us being on the schedule. It helps us out.
It does very indeed.
Helps us all out.
All right, so we will plan on proceeding with this as our schedule. And certainly, if things come up, we need to be fluid, but this is what we should plan for your calendars. Thanks, Bill.
And that's the sum total of my report, unless I forgot something.
Well, I'm just wondering, Bill, I think it would be good to have as a standing item between now and September. Matt, the management analysis staff, is not here, but that's a very important undertaking, and I'm just wondering if we should have as a standing agenda item, including starting today, just an update as to where we are, kind of where they are in the process, what issues are coming up. I know that you and Les and I met with Matt and Jim Cox did just to get a briefing, but I think it would be really helpful for other members to hear, you know, where we are in the project. I know you've got some handouts, but maybe just walk us through some of those, if you would.
Well, I plan to walk you through them on item 9.
Okay.
If we can hold off to then.
Sure, that's explained. Okay, hearing no further items from Bill. Bob, I'm going to turn it over to you for the Personnel Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The members will remember that I have two things I wanted to bring to the council's attention. One's an update on the executive director search process. Greg Huebner is with us from the Legislative Coordinating Commission, and Greg can help answer any questions, provide data and information we need as well. So I'll update you on the executive director search process, and then just to inform the council also about the Personnel Committee as well. You will recall that we've notified the public of an interest to fill a position for executive director. This is a position that is part of the Legislative Coordinating Commission under Greg Huebner's operations. We've completed the search process. Those applications were submitted by last Monday, I think it was. Last Monday. And these were all sent to Greg's office. Greg has received 45 applications. And I should make a note that the names and applications are non-public data and only become public at the time when the appointing authority determines who it is they want to interview. And so I'll get to that in a second. But then, so that's a very important thing to keep in mind. The process, I think I've talked to you before a little bit about it, but just to kind of maybe fill it in a little bit more. The process will take probably three or four stages. The first stage is now underway, and that is a staff group at Greg's direction is reviewing all 45 applications and narrowing the field to those individuals that they want to judge worthy of bringing in for interviews. That staff group is made up of Greg Knopf, Janelle, and Patrick McCormick. So they'll conduct the interviews, identify who they think the top candidates are, and forward those to a small group of the LaSard Council. That'll be made up of four individuals, myself, Senator Anderson, Representative Hansen, and the chair. And the four of us will then take the next stage, which is to conduct a second round of interviews, ask probably for some writing samples, do some reference and background checks, and so forth, and then make a recommendation of a candidate to the full Personnel Committee, which ideally we'll be able to do at our meeting in August on the 13th. So from a scheduling standpoint, members of the Personnel Committee should consider that we would probably have a period of time prior to the meeting on that day at 10 o'clock for the Personnel Committee to meet. So we'll have more details on that, but just to keep that in mind. At that time, the Personnel Committee will take action and make a recommendation to the full council for discussion and hopeful action also on that day, the 13th. So that's generally the stages of the process. Greg, am I missing anything, or have we kind of covered it? The other thing is to inform the council that, the chair mentioned this earlier, that we have kind of two interests that we want to keep in mind here. One is the open meeting law, and the other is to conduct these interviews on a confidential basis and in a forthright and frank manner. In order to do that, but without violating the open meeting law, we have to be mindful of participants and the issue of a quorum. Currently, the Personnel Committee is made up of four individuals, Representative Hansen, Senator Anderson, myself, and Jim Cox. And if three of us were to meet, we would be in violation of the open meeting law, which we don't want to do. So I am recommending to the chair that we expand the Personnel Committee to include an additional three members who would meet as a committee on the 13th of August to review the recommendation of this, I'm calling the Huebner Group, a small group who will conduct those interviews. And I've asked for volunteers and Wayne Inger and David Hartwell and Representative Gunther have all agreed to do that. So we'll be expanding the Personnel Committee to include those three additional members, the total then being seven. A quorum would then be four. So we would not be in violation then of the open meeting law and the quorum requirement. If three of us were, the Personnel Committee were to meet and engage in the interviews. So that's my report, Mr. Chair, on the process and the Personnel Committee expansion. And I'm happy to take any questions if there are.
Les.
Mr. Chair, you mentioned something
personnel committee would do the sorting and provide any candidate?
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, Les, the Huminger Group is at the, is a, I'm describing it, the Huminger Group, at the direction of Greg Huminger, myself, the chair, Senator Anderson, and Representative Hansen, will take a, the staff recommendations of candidates to be interviewed, and we'll conduct a second round of interviews, and second round of review, with the idea of being able to recommend to the full personnel committee a candidate for consideration as the executive director.
I guess I, Mr. Chair, I would take exception to that, for if this process is completed, you're basically making the entire selection process. I think the full council should have the selection between, say, the top three or four candidates to do the final full council selection. If we were to receive just one candidate, that gives us pretty much the decision that the personnel committee has made, and I think that's putting the horse a little bit before the back of the cart here. So I think we need to have a list of people, a short list of the top candidates for the final selection in both of the full council. Is that a required unanimous vote or a majority vote?
Well, Mr. Chair, Les, a couple of things. One is that we will review with the full council the process that we've gone through and the top candidates that we were interviewed under the, to be compliant with the public versus non-public nature of the interview process. The council can make a decision however they choose to make that time, and I'm not going to prejudge what that decision will be. But there will be a recommendation. But
they only have one candidate, the decision's already made. That's what I'm getting at.
There'll be one candidate recommended.
So just keep in mind that when we establish the personnel committee, one of the roles is to to do that function, to identify that candidate for the full council.
I really feel that this takes the selection process away from the full council, because you're providing your final recommendation, and I think that the council has to have at least a look at the top choices here to make that as a full council decision.
The personnel committee will be making a recommendation.
A recommendation with
of a candidate. Mr. Chair, it's my intention that the personnel committee will make a recommendation of a candidate.
One thing.
I would like to get a record. I think that is totally wrong. I think we have to have the option of the full council to make that final decision on the final candidate dates, not candidate.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Bobby suggested that there had three new members today.
To the personnel committee, yes.
Yeah. Right. And then they would be included in that process then?
Yes.
Of selecting that candidate?
Yes.
So it would be the four plus
the three. Correct. The seven.
Three, seven.
Right. And of course, like with any committee that we have, all council members are welcome to attend. They just can't exercise the voting privileges of a committee. But as we have with the grants program, we have non-committee members attending and participating in the discussion.
Right.
Any further questions?
Well, maybe Bill, a point of clarification then, Mr. Chair. So, Bob, when you get down to the final selection, you'll be interviewing maybe three or four different people at one final day. Is that fair to say? So if members wanted to be there for that, they could be?
Yes.
Non-voting.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Bob, can you clarify? You said that the information about the applicants changes from non-public to public at a certain point in the personnel committee process.
Yeah.
Where does that take effect?
The appointing authority in this case is the council.
Okay.
And at the time the council interviews candidates, their names are public. So up until that point, they are non-public. Does that answer your question?
So just in terms of assuming we successfully get to the point where we identify a candidate that we agree that we want to hire, what happens then?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, my I expect that the recommendation will be that the council asks Mr. Huminger to engage in negotiations with that candidate.
Okay. So assuming that occurs in August, we will assume that by September, if everything goes well, we should have a permanent executive director on staff. Is that a correct assumption or a realistic assumption? Okay.
And Mr. Chair, I believe the law requires the LCC to either approve it or to not disapprove it. So something, there has to be a step with the LCC, but hopefully that would be a routine and quick.
And again, Greg, does the LCC meet fairly regularly when they're not in session, so we aren't going to get hung up by waiting for them to meet and review our recommendation?
Mr. Chair, it's likely that that decision was made by the leadership of the LCC and not the full commission.
I see. Okay.
Good. Other question?
Yeah, Bill.
Question. To you, sir, is this a normal process when you select an executive director to a commission like this, that you have a personnel committee of a group that does the selection and brings that one name forward, or is it two, or is it three, or is it all over the place? Just to get a better feel for how it's been done in the past.
The typical pattern, Senator, would be for the personnel committee or a subgroup to make a recommendation of a single candidate to the commission or to the council.
Mr. Chair and Bill, that's how we did it with the LCCMR, and I did participate in that personnel. We just hired a new director just in the last year, so that's very much what we did with the help of Mr. Hubinger, who really helped coordinate the process for us.
Any other comments or questions on that? If not, thank you. And the committee has been expanded now to include Wayne, Dave Hartwell, and Representative Gunther. The next item on the agenda is an update on the Conservation Partners Grant Program. And Denise, if you would, again, welcome. And if you have a guest with you, that's great.
Yes.
Hi, welcome. Leslie, welcome.
Thank you.
Yes. You could just state your name for the record.
Well, good morning. My name is Denise Anderson, and I'm the Chief Financial Officer with the Department of Natural Resources.
And I'm Leslie Cantwell. I'm the Conservation Grant Program Manager.
So at last month's meeting, the council approved our accomplishment plan that was presented, and thank you for that. And what we've done is any request of periodic updates from us so you can be aware of the status of where we're at. So since that time, our primary focus has been to get staff in place, manage the program. So we're pleased to announce that Leslie Cannonhill has been hired to head up the program. She's been with the DNR since 1988. She's worked on a number of grant programs like the Heritage Grant Program and the National American Wetland Conservation Act grant program. So Leslie is here today to provide you with an update on the other activities that have been going on in the past month as well.
The main thing we're trying to work on is getting an assistant to help me out. And so we've got people in mind. We're just working through the hiring process with that and making sure we can fill behind them. Our other priorities have been the communication plan and also the RFP, request for proposal. We had a meeting yesterday with our communication staff through our I&E Bureau. And there's also the website has gone up. I think some of you have looked at that. We did some updates on that yesterday. And we're hoping as we get questions in from the public, we'll develop a frequently asked questions page to go along with that. So that'll probably be our first main source of information for folks as we develop things and go along the way. We're also working internally and externally with people inside the DNR without the professional level staff, so we can figure out how we're going to work all the approvals and different plans that we need to do and get as many people as we can into the loop. And so I've worked with some of the different divisions in our department, and I've also talked with John Jashy from Bowser and some of his staff on just how we can work together on these programs. There's an email box available online for folks to drop questions to me, and that we've had a couple come in that way. Then we're working on some various public relations outreach opportunities. We're hoping to develop some kind of postcard fairly shortly and using a variety of mailing lists that DNR has, Bowser has, and any other conservation contacts that we can get to get some information. Probably mostly referring to the website at this point, because that's where our information is, but maybe a brief outline too of the program and the deadlines that are important for folks to know. Then we're also looking at having something available for state fair and game fair. It'll just depend on how fast we can pull these things off with just me or maybe short length assistance. So we've got staff support behind us, and that's what we're counting on a lot to do. The RFP, we're going to try to run a program similar to the Heritage Enhancement Grant Program, because there are a lot of similarities there, and the Heritage Enhancement Program is up and running. So it's probably the formatting for two programs will be the same under, as the RFP is, just different specific information for each program. The application process, we're working on developing an online application, and that's going to take a little bit of time. So we're just trying to decide if there's something available that we can use and tap into, or do we need to develop something totally new? And that's what we're looking at this week or so. But especially if we get the 500 or so applications that we're hoping for this program, there's no way we can handle it manually. We're going to need that electronic assistance to load things at least initially into a database and work from there to help us sort things out. So that's our program for that. So it'll be online, and hopefully be as user-friendly as cost-efficient as we can. But also with being the one-year pilot program, we're kind of stuck as to how much time and money we invest in that, which will still make it work for us. That's pretty much what we
have. The RFP is due out like at the end of August, with a timeline of them being back by
November 3rd. And we're hoping to have the application system up mid to late September, just because the RFP is the key thing to let people think about and start working with various resource professionals. And I think we just don't have time to get the application process up until mid September, probably, mid to late.
Questions? Ellen. Yes.
Yeah, just a couple questions. One is about the RFP process, the application. Are you trying to keep that sort of short, sweet, simple, so that it's real accessible for not, you know, people who don't have lobbyists and don't have necessarily a grant professional on staff, et cetera?
Yeah. We're trying to make it easy as we can. We really need to know things like who the organization is, who their contact is, if they're working on public land, who that public land manager is, you know, how much money are they asking for, where, because there's a required match, where is that match coming from, what kind of work are they going to do, what kind of activity, how many acres are they going to affect, you know, kind of get like maybe a cost per acre issue or number, and that way we can figure out how cost effective the program is. Is it going to be volunteer work or are they contracted out? We need some of that information up front, and that is similar to the Heritage Enhancement Program. They have to give us that information. So we are going to need to sort through some things like, is it a project where they're returning dirt and we need to have historical review? Is it, which kind of land is it on? Is it on public land? Is that DNR? Is it county? Is it city? Is it private land? Is that land under permanent conservation easement? So we're going to have some of those questions in there. It's not just an easy, we want 5,000 bucks. But we're going to try to make it easy as we can and have some of our resource professionals work with them on that, especially with us to have your details.
And Mr. Chair, we did, I guess we did approve a list of things we wanted as criteria for all our applications, so obviously those have to be included as well. I just have another question, and this is something that applies not just to this, but to our whole RFP process, and it just sort of came up in the LCCMR process that somebody raised an objection that for the first time we put the applications online, all of the whole request of all requesters online. And do we have a practice of, will we be doing that when you get an application in? Has anyone thought that through?
As far as it's public or not?
Yes, whether it's public information.
Under the grant policy, there is a point where they're non-public, and then they become public, much like your personal hiring thing, and I frankly can't remember what that is. I know it's out there, I need to look at it. But when they enter their applications into the database, we're hoping that they will be able to scroll in and edit if they need to. And obviously, that myself or the assistant will be able to look at them too, so we can make sure they're accurate and go back and get more information. But I think there's a certain point when those become public, and I don't know if it is off the top of my head.
No.
You know, Mr. Chair, it just got kind of raised some alarm bells, and I'd like to know a little bit more about this, if maybe we could have a follow-up on that at some point, if Bill wouldn't mind just getting us, telling us what the law says about that. Just for information, I served on the NextGen Energy Board, and that's a little different because that was money appropriated to a state agency, and we were serving as a board, but to administer those funds, and it was sort of it was interpreted so extremely that we as members of the board were not allowed to look at the RFPs because it was considered there was too much proprietary or personal private information, financial data, etc. And the LCCMR has gone to the other extreme and posted the full applications online so anyone can see. And I had a project proposer come to me and say, hey, I didn't know that was going to be online, and there's some data I didn't really want to be public. So it's just an issue to think about.
And that's something we can explain in the RFP as well, what is public and what is public.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Scott, on this point?
I have a question, but I can wait if it's not my turn.
We have, unless it's on this point, we'll get you in just a minute or two, okay?
It is relevant to the small grants program, but not this particular point.
Okay, Bob?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, a couple of things. The suggestion, Leslie, that, and I'm sure you've already got this in mind, but one of the things that will be of value to the council will be to report to the legislature on the success of the program. And that'll come through a lot of things, but one of them will be data elements. So I'm sure you're keeping that in mind, but however, you know, thinking of what the end product is for the council, which is a report of all of the data elements that can be sorted, counties, acres, enhancements, restoration, you know, all that kind of stuff would be great, and I'm sure you have that in mind. And then also, I suggested this to Bill, and you probably already have it in your plan, but I've always found it most helpful to take a test run. You know, whatever that application looks like, shop it around to some folks whose judgment that you trust and who can give you honest feedback so that it makes that, they'll find things that you hadn't thought about that can make an improvement. So that's just a 2 cents. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep.
Mr. Chair, Leslie, I would have next on my list to call after reading the proposal. I talked to Don Schultz, our Department of Wildlife Manager, and I was a little concerned of it appears that most of the requests are going to be coming to you. And I'm thinking that I would like to see our wildlife managers get more actively involved in some of the finance screening, because we've got some of these small clubs out there. For example, Hoops Unlimited, the Eagle Lake Sportsman Club, Riversville Fishing Game, where I don't know that everybody can feel comfortable on the online, some of them may not, but a person like Don Schultz is the at that scene to say, hey, this is a good project, this is not a good project, because, and do some pre-sorting, because you're going to have a very difficult time at the state level looking at all these projects if they start rolling in. I would like to get, if we put the regional or the district or the county wildlife manager right immediately in queue. And Don was very enthusiastic about doing that. And I'm sure that the other wildlife managers would be a very good funding source. And make sure that this is going to be synergy with the whole county.
Yeah, exactly.
You need
to involve
the
Scott, are you, do you have a question?
I'm here. My question is for Leslie. Is there any intention to have some outreach about our Conservation Partners Program at Game Fair in Anoka for the 2 weekends in August that's held? Because I think that we could reach a lot of potential groups there that might be interested in applying for grants.
Yeah, we've discussed that and we're working on that possibility.
Did you hear that, Scott?
I did not.
So Leslie said, yes, they're discussing that, they thought about that, and they're working on trying to get that set up if they have their materials available in time.
Thank you.
Yeah, Phil.
To that point, is there a media release too? Do you have a list of media? I mean, would that be helpful at all? Small papers?
We've got our DNR list that we send out for our regular elder meetings. Yep, we've got something
else
we'll do that.
Phil?
And we also have the 800 or so Lassard Sands on the Heritage Council list of people who have actually asked to be on the list. So,
Wayne?
Mr. Leslie, first of all, thank you for taking on this challenge, because I know this first shot at this thing is a little difficult, but it looks like you've had some experience in another one. What is that similar program that you said you've been running, and how many dollars and how many applications?
Sure. It's the Heritage Enhancement Grants Program. I started back in 2002, and I was hired on probably 6 months or so after it got up and running. Currently, the budget for this coming fiscal year is $440,000. Last year, I think it was $450,000. Last year, we received 29 applications, and we funded, I believe, I want to say about 19 grants to something like 16 clubs. So, and there's some differences between the programs. For instance, there's no match required with that one. They're required to work on WMAs or land under wildlife control, so it's a much narrower focus. but a lot of the things are similar.
Bill, to this point again, what was the dollar maximum on that? I think we have a maximum.
$400,000 is our,
okay, what was the maximum?
The total funding for this coming year is $440,000, and there really is no maximum. Most of the clubs that apply are cognizant of the total amount that's available, and they don't want to take all the money, so they're pretty good. I mean, they'd like to, but they know we don't want to get it out.
Luckily, what we may see in this, what you may see in this program are some requests for acquisitions. How does that change the picture in terms of the process versus a club that wants to go in and do some enhancement work on grasslands currently managed by the DNR through a WMA program? Can you give us a little bit of sense of how that process will differ, because obviously it's going to be a lot more involved.
Yeah. Not exactly. Well, just acquisition itself is more time consuming, and it will probably depend on what the state the acquisition is at now. Have they got an idea what that piece of land is, or have they been talking to a landowner, and if it's supposedly going to go to DNR, where is it at? Have we done the survey? Have we done an appraisal? Have we auctioned it? They're just going to fund it to buy it for us? We don't know that yet, and that may be part of the funding requirement when we really look at it. You know, we want to fund something with no idea, or we want something with results. Something to sort through. It'll be tougher and will require more documentation, a lot of which you laid out in the legislation to acquire that land.
Another question for you. There was some really nice publicity on you and the program in the outdoor news last week, and probably other places. What have you heard from the public? Have you been receiving calls already? And tell us a little bit about any inquiries about the program.
Just a few. Through the website, I got a question from one of the counties about, you know, here's a project we'd like to do, does it fit with this program? But not a whole lot of other public calls. Within our agency and other agencies, you know, there's been a lot of support, you know, we'll help you as we can and what do you need done type stuff. But I haven't heard a whole lot of public comments. I'm not sure where our field staff is. We've got some meetings set up to go out and talk with our internal staff and also with Bowser's staff that's forthcoming. We need to, as you said, you know, you want our front end, our field staff involved on the front end, so we need to go out and talk to them first so they can be that outreach for us as well.
So,
historically, I've gotten about a call a week about this program and when it's going to be ready. So now I have some place to direct them.
Any other questions for Leslie or Denise? If not, thank you both for coming up here and for the update, and we'll look forward to the next update in August. Next item on the agenda, we have two accomplishment plans before us that we need to look at and hopefully approve. So I'd like to take those in the order that they're listed on our agenda. The first is accelerate the waterfall production area program in Minnesota, and Matt Holland from Presence Forever is here. Matt, welcome, and thanks for taking the time to come up here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Matt Holland. I'm Senior Field Coordinator for Pheasants Forever. Here to discuss and answer any questions about the accelerating the waterfall production area program in Minnesota. Just to update you on where we're at, we've had two or three meetings with Ducks Unlimited, the Fish and Wildlife Service, and Pheasants Forever to develop a project list, which is basically the new element that is in this plan since you last saw it. You will see on page 7 a list of potential waterfall production areas, additions for new areas. This list came up from the wetland management districts of the Fish and Wildlife Service that are throughout Minnesota. So those projects came up through that process to Jim Leach, who testified before you related this project. This represents a subset of the backlog that Jim referenced this winter. And these projects have been vetted through the biological process. I think you heard a little bit about from Rex Johnson and Purvis Falls. And Ducks Unlimited and Pheasants Forever are also aware of these projects and support these projects. So that is the project list, and so we're ready to hit the ground running take these on. So that's the only addition to the accomplishment plan.
Okay. Questions for Matt on this work plan? Bill?
So what you've done is tapped into the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's acquisition program and are using all of their field staff to identify possible acquisitions and to go through the list of possible ones and find those that are the best bang for the buck.
Mr. Chair, yes, and again, this is, we saw a subset of what was submitted to Jim Leach through their wetland management district personnel that, you know, these are all willing participants here. The landowners have been in contact with the Fish and Wildlife Service staff. They meet the biological criteria as well as are either, I think for the most part, a lot of these are additions to existing units, but there are some new WPAs as well that meet the criteria. So yes, we've gotten together, worked out priorities, and we've got a list to go forward.
And each one of these, is it true, went through the strategic habitat conservation process, the adaptive management process with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service does? It's based on research and modeling? And
I believe, yes. I have to check with Jim to make sure everyone, but all of these were on the list that have gone through that process, where they all scored out. I don't have all the SWAT scores and things like that that they do, but all of these met their biological criteria that would enter them into National Wildlife Refuge System.
And the objective of that is to restore an ecosystem or some part of an ecosystem, and it's done in a scientific manner?
Yes. We're looking at the thunderstorm maps, looking at wetland, grassland, habitat complexes, and adding the pieces of that puzzle to make that ecosystem function.
So by funding this, we advance that process?
Correct.
Ellen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you say thunderstorm maps?
Yes, I did.
What does that mean?
Those are the, Mr. Chair, I wasn't at the Fergus Falls meeting, but I assume Rex Johnson talked about the breeding, the breeding pair densities. That, mm-hmm. You know, they've got tremendous data on waterfowl breeding pair densities, and obviously their charge is to manage for waterfowl, and so these are in areas where the densities meet their criteria to advance the waterfowl production areas.
And those are called thunderstorm? Why are they called thunderstorm maps?
They have a strange resemblance to the radar maps that you see on TV.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Color-coded to the densities of green waterfowl.
Okay.
So theoretically, you know, in the thunderstorm map, you've got a red area, you've got the severe thunderstorm. It's a severe case of waterfall density.
Got it. So. All right. Good to know. Well, Mr. Chair, I actually have another. That's helpful. Thank you. Are any of the lands that you'll be acquiring protected by permanent conservation easements?
No.
Mr. Chairman, there are some properties here that have perpetual conservation easements on them. I'm hearing that there are some issues here that we're certainly aware of. Right now, we would not be approaching any of the properties that are completely protected by easements. They're not on our top flight list here, and we're going to put those over here on the side. However, there are some projects here that have, you know, maybe a 200-acre tract that has a 17-acre rim easement in the middle of that, you know, and I talked to Bill about that a little bit. We're, I guess the way we're approaching it until we get further clarification is we would attempt to get those acres purchased or donated to the landowner or through non-LSOHC funds. So that we want, you know, we proceed with the project, but understand that.
Yep.
That's our approach.
Great. That is a very important issue. Bob?
And Mr. Chair, Matt, thanks for coming in. The question for you is on the front page, we say we're going to restore and conserve approximately 800 acres of grassland, 400 acres of wetland. And on page 7, we have a list of all the different properties, the total acreage of which is probably 3,000 or more. Can you explain the difference between those two numbers?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The list is a list of potential projects. And, you know, land acquisition is this list will change as time goes on. Sellers come and go, projects come and go all the time due to a wide variety of factors. You know, so this list is, again, a high-graded list of the backlog. We may be coming in and adding projects if all of our projects fall off the list. You know, we got to go down the list to pick them up. So The ultimate goal is to meet the acre objectives that we lay out on the first page. We think we can get that from this project, which we hope we can get that from.
Bob, is Paul?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, so method, so the minimum amount of effort will be 1,200 acres, the acre plus four. But it's conceivable, am I correct, that you will potentially go beyond that?
Mr. Chairman, we would like to do that, absolutely. And we hope to be able to, through our other efforts, whether it's working with landowners to donate, working with North American Western Conservation Act, other sources of private funds to try and expand as much as we can.
Thank you.
Joe?
Just a little bit of history on the list. This approach was actually developed by Senator Merriam when he was chair of Senate Finance, and he added the list to provide some better definition of what the bonding programs were doing, and to make sure that the bonding programs didn't have to come back for approval time after time after time as things changed. We negotiated approving a list larger than the money available could buy, so the program could move to the there to be the top priorities. However, that same approach was adopted by LCCMR and has worked effectively for them, and I think it'll work effectively for us if we understand exactly what we're doing.
Other questions? I have a couple, Matt. First one, it actually relates to the list. I look at the list, and I look at the map on the back, and for example, I have 12 dots in Otter Tail County, and I've got one Otter Tail County project. Can you help me understand that?
Mr. Chair, the map is a reflection, I guess the map did not get changed to reflect the actual projects.
Okay.
This is a map that was produced by the Fish and Wildlife Service at the time of the proposal. So it is not an accurate reflection of what this project is. I can certainly ask Mr. Leach to generate a new map.
That would be great. Yeah, we would do that. Another question I had to do with the timing. Assuming that we approve the work plan today so we can get moving, when do you think the first acquisition might be complete? Just roughly. Are we looking at some acquisitions that might occur yet this late summer, early fall, or are we quite a ways out?
Mr. Chairman, the acquisition process, you know, you're required to do an appraisal. We're ready to order appraisals today. Should you approve it? We actually have already done some on the private side. We're working with our partners, Fish and Wildlife Service staff, and have met with some of the landowners just again to make sure that they're still interested in going through with this process. I would say we may have some deals secured in 8 weeks, maybe to be secured. Whether in closing would be sometime after that.
Great, that's great. Just the last question I have is, of course, according to the Constitution, that unless otherwise specified, these lands will remain open to public hunting and fishing, taking a fish and game, I guess is the right word. And so I'm looking on page 2 of the accomplishment plan. It's more of just a confirmation, where on the top of the page it says here that acquisition will occur within 18 months, so on and so forth. Waterfall production areas will be open for public recreation according to the National Wildlife Refuge System Improvement Act. Can we assume then that, given the constitutional use of the funds, that all of these properties will be open for public recreation?
Yes, and I can, Mr. Chairman, I can't speak to the actual act itself, but these will all become waterfall production areas. Yes. They're all open public hunting right now.
Okay.
What it actually says in that act, I can't tell you, but I assume that there will also be some sort of notice of grant agreement put on the deed to these properties so that if anything changes, there will be some recourse to the council for the investment that the district makes.
Okay. Any further discussion or questions on the work plan as proposed? If not, I'd entertain a motion to approve the work plan.
I'd like to move that we approve the work plan presented by Matt Hoffman for the Ontario Heritage Fund recommendation of $560,000.
Further discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you very much.
Look forward to that first acquisition.
Keep going.
That's right, sir.
Been waiting for.
That's right.
Phil, just a question about the point you made, the National Wildlife Refuge System Improvement Act. Is there something we should find out about or be informed about?
I think that's a good idea, Bill. I was thinking the very same thing. Phil, can you check into that? Obviously, the intent, and I don't think there's any misrepresentation, keep all the open as part of the waterfall production area system, but for me personally, I think it would be a great idea to have a better sense of what that means in terms of public recreation and management of those properties.
I will do that. Sure.
The other accomplishment report or plan that we have before us is from the Department of Natural Resources. Denise is here to talk about the management of the contracts with the appropriations from the Outdoor Heritage Fund for fiscal year 2010. Denise, welcome back.
This accomplishment plan then is for the work that the DNR will be doing to manage the appropriations that come through the DNR and are passed through to third-party recipients. So for each of these appropriations, DNR will be conducting financial reviews if they're required by state policy, prepare and execute agreement documents, review expenditure documentation, ensure that recipients are reimbursed only for allowable expenses, and assist the recipients with closing agreements. And administering this program will be complying with the Department of Admin's Office of Grant Management Policies. We have 13 policies out there that we will be ensuring that we follow those. The payments would be made on the payments to the grant recipients or the the payments to the grant recipients will be administered on a reimbursement basis unless it's been otherwise approved in the accomplishment plan. And reimbursements would not start before November 1st. Recipients must verify that they've met all of the requirements laid out in their legislation. And the periodic payments will not be made unless it's if they're passed through progress reports that are required. Let's see, the budget, the contract management cost will be billed at a professional services rate of $60 an hour, and that's similar to how we laid it out in the small grant program that we just discussed. Our goal would be to get a grant specialist intermediate hired and as soon as possible to get them going. We plan to get a letter out to the recipients as soon as possible, kind of lay out timelines, let them know where we're at with the program. And our goal would be to have all of the agreements signed and executed by November 1st so that they can begin to get their reimbursement on time.
Questions? Bob?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just to deepen the point that I had raised before for the small grants program, but also, and am I correct that you guys will also be collecting and be able to report the data elements of how the program is going to the council? You know, how much money has gone out?
Yes, we would be.
You know, all of the reporting elements that are traditional from this kind of thing.
Yes, from a contract management standpoint, we would be in terms of, like you said, the amount expended, how much is remaining in the agreements. But in terms of the accomplishments of the recipients, I'd like for them to be reporting.
Right.
I might add to that as we go forward and get more appropriations out, it'll be important to have a total number of agreements under, or projects under agreement. This will build. Last time I looked at the LCCMR contract management, there were 60 some odd agreements. That
were still open.
Yes, yes. So in any one year, you have 3 years of agreements open.
Mr. Chair, do you have the plans to do any front-end advertising or distribution other than the website on the function of the grant, how it gets out in the field, how people in the field are notified of this program?
These are actually grants that have been, I think, recommended by the council and the legislature approved, so they're really...
This is not in the small grants.
Denise, there's a two sentences on the bottom of page two that concern me a lot. I'd like to get a little bit of clarification. The last two sentences, it says, this staff time is currently underfunded. And then it goes on to say, other unfunded project costs include the cost for activities necessary for DNR to receive donated land and technical guidance. Can you explain those? And how is that going to, I mean, that's not good. And we need to know how that's going to impact your ability as an agency to manage these grants.
Right now, we're estimating that it'll take one FTE of work to do the contract management portion of this work. So at a professional services rate of $60 an hour and a budget of $175,000, if we have someone on full time for the first year, which may not be the case because we don't have them on yet, we anticipated that we'd spend $125,000. So if it's $125,000 a year, then we'd be short next year for that. Also, there's requirements in there about DNR approving some of the projects that have been recommended or coming through the grant recipients. So a lot of that time is not funded through this agreement. So the DNR will be doing some tracking internally to see how much time they are spending on these types of activities that are currently not funded. And we may be coming back to the council to talk about that. So we need to get some history on how much time we'll be spending on this.
So my guess is that you front-end loaded, in terms of the three fiscal years, the cost. My guess is, given the nature of the work and that this is a reimbursement, these are reimbursement contracts, that probably it will be flip-flop, that a lot of those costs will be incurred in the out years and not in fiscal 10. We're in fiscal 10 now. Matt indicated there might be a closing very shortly, but a lot of the enhancement restoration work is not going to be, you're not going to see a bill for it until the work is done. And so, you know, I guess I need a little bit better clarity about how you're going to be able to handle that a year from now when you've budgeted $50,000, but you're anticipating it's going to cost you $125,000 to manage it.
We'll have the upfront work, in terms of the contract management piece of it, but we'll have the upfront work of getting the agreements finalized and signed out there. And you're right, I mean, if we don't spend in the first year, would be available then in the following year. So we'll have a better handle later in the year how much that may be.
Bill?
When the council is putting together its recommendations for the 10 legislature, which will be late this fall, will you come and give us an update on where you're at and let us know whether or not there's any need to fund additional contract management, especially for the proposals that will be funded in FY11?
So I'm just trying to figure out how we got into this situation, because this, the legislature didn't cut this appropriation or this recommendation. I mean, what was appropriated for grants management was what was recommended. Did we just underestimate, or how did we get into a situation where we're saying we're unfunding a good part of this work?
It's my understanding that the estimate was based on what the LCCMR currently provides for contract management to the DNR. The funding that historically has come from the LCCMR has only covered the staff time of the person that manages the grant program. It doesn't cover any of the supplies or expense costs that might be directly related to managing the program. It doesn't include any of the staff time that is responsible for entering encumbrances into the state system. It doesn't cover any staff time for the person who actually processes the bills through the system. So historically, that funding has not fully covered our costs. And we're trying to move to a model where that doesn't happen.
Any other questions? No.
Mr. Chair, so do you expect the DNR to put in a budget request then for this additional amount next year? Or is that...
If that's where I was going.
Is that where you're going? Or is that something that I should ask Mr. Meyer? Or
yeah,
wait and see?
And we would have to work through our internal review channels for that.
But that hasn't, Mr. Chair, that's not why it appears here. It hasn't become an official position of the agency that this should, you're just reflecting the cost as you know it.
Bill?
There will be a need for the council to finance the management of the contracts that are associated with the 10 legislative session appropriations. I think one of the questions here is whether or not when you put the two appropriations together and fund each one separately, whether you have at the DNR a unit that's capable of handling the full workload. And if that were the case, then annual recommendations and appropriations to the department would be necessary to keep this project, this program afloat, basically. The alternative is to appropriate a full 3 years worth of personnel and then try to figure out how much of that can be used on the 10 legislative session or 11 legislative session contracts. This seemed to be a simpler way, one day in March.
Any other comments? So I guess the message there is keep us posted on these costs, because so the last thing we need is, or would like to see, is that we're not providing the resources you need to be able to effectively manage these contracts. With that, I entertain a motion to adopt the work plan, or the accomplishment plan. So there's a motion on the table to adopt the accomplishment plan for managing these contracts with the fiscal year 10 Outdoor Heritage Fund appropriations. Further discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, James. Next item is a contract that we have in the interim for with the DNR for the administrative services of the council. Bill?
In your package, you'll find an interagency agreement form that looks something like this. There are actually two interagency agreement forms. Get the one without the cover sheet, the one that looks like this. Wayne, you got the wrong one.
Why not?
And basically, this provides the council with administrative services from DNR as they have been historically provided from the 1st of December 2008. It provides those services out through the end of September. The amount of the agreement is $40,000. I looked at the spending plan earlier this week, and my guess is most of that will be expended. I apologize for the PDF and copying that's got the signature page on the wrong, backing up the first page. I did want to direct your attention to the top of page 2. This does not cover council expenditures for consultants, member travel, and per diem and field expenses. Those will be paid directly by LCC out of the funds available to them. And we'll see some of those in the next agenda item. And expenses incurred by DNR in support of the council will be approved and processed through monthly invoices under paragraph 4. So we'll have a tracking method to see where we're going with this. Greg is here, Gubinger, if you have anything you'd like to add. Okay. So I just wanted to make you all aware that this is in place and that you have some help until you find a new executive director.
Thank you. Any questions for Bill on this contract? Hey, Bill, next item is the planning project.
Right. There are two items in your packet. I believe it's two, maybe three. There are four items in your packet to deal with the planning project, the next four items. They start with a management analysis and development interagency agreement and go through a stapled set of papers that has at the top invitees or invites for the LSOHC conservation professional and public meetings. So the two items look like this. And this is going to take a few minutes to get through. So the first item is an interagency agreement between Management Analysis and Development and the LCC to implement the planning, strategic planning process approved by the council in Alexandria. The sum of the contract is $71,375. It is a contract that's on a billable hour basis, and you can see on page 3 of this agreement that it's estimating 550 hours at $125 per hour. The information that they plan to collect is going to be done thusly. As we agreed, we'll put together a, for each of the SARD SAMS sections, we'll put together a draft or straw dog list of 25-year goals and one-year targets and priority actions. Those are being gathered from existing plans, such as the duck recovery plan, the species of greatest concern, things of that sort. And we will then take that straw dog to what I would consider to be a series of Delphi groups consisting of conservation professionals who are knowledgeable about the geography of the section, and they will verify the accuracy and truthfulness of these goals, and they will scrub out any overlap that they see there. They'll add anything that they think is missing, and they'll add priority actions. I'd like to direct your attention to the last page, last set, which has the meeting dates and locations as they've been set up by Management Analysis and Development. The meeting dates right now are New Ulm, August 4th at the Holiday Inn, St. Paul, August 6th at the MRS building, Rochester at the University Center on August the 7th, Grand Rapids, August the 11th, Forest History Center, and Detroit Lakes, August 17th at the future Holiday Inn, formerly the Clubhouse Hotel. What will happen is the morning and most of the afternoon will be occupied by the professionals discussing these targets for prairies, wetlands, forests, and habitat, and restoration, protection, and enhancement. And they will finalize the list, and then later that afternoon the public will come in and be able to view the results and provide comments to be collected by the Department of Administration, Management Analysis and Development. MAD will collate those for each section, and on September the 15th, bring that information to the council for their review and approval. We hope to have it in your hands, obviously, well before the 15th. The job of the council at that time is basically twofold. One, to resolve the public input comments with the professional opinion. The second one is to resolve or rationalize the sections for the state as a whole. Each section is planning independently. The council will have to make sure that the goals make sense as a whole for the state. I think this is the opportunity for council members and the council to formally, through the process, to identify holes and gaps and make sure that they're filled, and to eliminate anything that they think is problematic from any point of view that they might want to espouse, I suppose. Then the results of that day's work become the priorities that the council will build into its call for requests. So in the end, we think that the call for requests will, for example, for the northeast section, be something like protect 100,000 acres of forest over the next 25 years. The first year goal or target would be 10,000 acres of forest and protect them through easement acquisition, perhaps even as direct as enumerating the program that ought to be funded. This is a lot of work to do in a very short period of time. And it's going to take a while to get it up and running. We've worked real hard to date. I have provided for you on the back of that same handout piece that we were just talking about a list of conservation professionals to date that will be at each meeting. You can see that, for example, in New Ulm, we have people from the Fish and Wildlife Service, from the Department of Natural Resources, from Pheasants Forever, from Ducks Unlimited, from the Nature Conservancy, from the Board of Water and Soil Resources, from the Natural Resource Conservation Service, from Mankato State University. So it's a pretty extensive list. And we are, in addition, contacting the entities listed on page 11 of 11 to see if they have conservation professionals who ought to be at one or more of these meetings. Our consultants under this contract are extraordinarily intelligent, hardworking, fair. I think that they're going to provide a real asset in terms of making sure that this is a process that meets the muster of being a fair and open process, which is required by law. So I will have them come to the August meeting, and you can grill them if you want. If you have comments about what's going on here, now's the time to bring them up, and I'll see what we can address those comments.
So, Bill, just to sort of, if I'm interpreting this right, by the time we have our next meeting, four of the five LSOHC sectional input meetings will have already been concluded, with the remaining one just in a few days.
That's correct.
Bill? Yeah, Ellen and then Darby.
Well, on that point, did you talk, and since I missed the last meeting, I don't know, did you talk about council members trying to attend some of these meetings? Well, are we encouraging that? Will we be able to get our expenses covered to do that, those who are able to be there and listen?
I think that's a good decision to be made today.
Mm-hmm. I would encourage council members to attend as many of these as possible. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's part of the function of the council, is to not only participate, but they may have questions that, you know, that this management analysis staff can't interpret, Bill might not be able to, that it might take a council member's interpretation. So, yes, I would encourage members to attend.
Darcy? Yeah. Bill, just a quick question that I understand this properly. These lists, conservation professionals, this is not the end of the list. I mean, we're still gathering additional folks. When do we, I mean, we've talked about this on the Monday meeting, I guess. When do we expect kind of the final list to be?
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow?
This is a very fast process.
All right.
And I will circulate it. And if you have a comment or a need, please get back to me rapidly. And they're not going to send it out till, they're not going to issue the invitations until Monday.
Okay. What? Mr. Chair, I'd just like to
discuss briefly, we had on Monday with the NAS group. One of the concerns that we had, it was a small group, non-forum group, just to understand the principle and understand the methodology which is going to be used for this. And then kind of tying into some of the comments from yesterday's meeting also, as far as being very specific on the constitutional language and being very directive and concise. I've put together just a rough amendment that I would like to see in consideration. I'd like to make a motion to approve this amendment for consideration on that first page. And I'll just pass a copy back out to everybody. And there's some technicalities about re-stressing fish, game, wildlife, and also the land acquired by the 97A as far as open public access. And also the definitions of resource that demands, which we as Hillstar Agricultural Heritage Council have approved for our recommendations for the next funding. The concern, you know, just a general concern with the meeting yesterday was in the discussions with the LCCMR. One of the benefits that the LCCMR looked at was having the freedom to move across different areas, education, training, research, and so forth. And one of the negatives that they considered the LSR Council to have is not being able to do that. Well, I kind of look at that in reversal and say this is a positive that the LSR Council has to be able to focus very specifically and concisely with constitutional dictates as to what we can do and what we can't do to make sure that we provide what the voters were really voting for as far as defining our projects and programs. Under the matrix that you've put together, Bill, other than you know, the spatial targets, the funding targets, and priority actions, I think are all reasonable filtering out processes that are going to take place, but under the guise of protecting fish for fish, game, and wildlife, using that additional definition in that front column to just make just a more solid definition of what we're really doing for. Any questions on that? I would like to submit this as an amendment for consideration for you in the final document.
So I'd ask Bill to just kind of provide a context for what Les is talking about, and Bob.
Les is talking about amending the document with the colored map on the front of it. Is that correct, Les?
That's correct. And the next page with the matrix.
And I just want to point out on the front first page of that document, at the bottom of the document is an attribution, and it's a Minnesota management and budget document. So I'm not sure how we amend that. I think we could have a motion that is instructive to the MAD group that could effectively get done what needs to be done.
Would you like me to make that motion?
Bob.
Hang on for just a second.
Bob?
Go ahead, Les. I'm honestly a little confused. Frankly, I'm trying to figure out where this all fits, and I'm trying to understand what you're getting at, but your motion might help me.
Yeah, go ahead, Emma.
Okay, if we could make a motion to amend the management budget document to include the more detailed specified in the constitutional language that we have included in the background information, but I think the focus on the definition of resource that can enhance and utilizing these terms in the definition of our matrix, I think, is very important. But this is one of the things that we were concerned about as far as how is this sorting out of all the plans and the data really then get down to the final working document for the strategic conservation implementation and so forth. So there's a lot of things that are going to have to happen from that initial MAD document to the final implementation, and that really isn't this way. I think that's what the meetings are going to sort out, is through putting those pieces together in there.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, yeah, Bob.
I'm sorry, let's just, I think, I'm hearing a couple of different things here, so I'm going to just try and piece, think of just one of them. What I think I'm hearing you say is that in the final document, and I'm this is my question to you, in the final document that management analysis creates, and in the process that leads up to it, the terms protect, restore, and enhance are those that you're suggesting on the bottom half of your amendment.
Correct.
All right, so you're proposing that we be sure to, that it's understood by all the parties that participate and in the end product, that it is understood that the definitions are these. That's okay, I understand that. All right. Okay, I buy that.
Okay. And maybe a footnote, the other thing you were saying, I think, Klaus, in your motion is that when we talk about protect, enhance, restore, it's for fish, game, and wild.
That's correct. In the allocation basis.
So I guess a question would be, and this is a question for the council, is this something we need to take an action on, or is this something that we can just ask Bill as the interim executive director to direct MAD when they work through this document that they include, you know, these things in their document? And I think that's really the heart of the motion. I don't think there's any disagreement left about, at least I'm not sensing any disagreement about the substance. The question is whether it needs to be a formal motion or just a direction to the executive director.
Mr. Chair, just the last couple of discussions, I think it's just very important that we reiterate each step of the way to make sure that we're very concise and clear on what our objective and goals are.
And Mr. Chair, just to be clear, and unless these three definitions for protect, restore, and enhance came directly from the original principal document that the council approved, I believe, in January.
That's correct.
Frank? Mr. Chair, I guess I don't believe there's anything wrong with making a little more stronger emphasis by saying yes, that we support something as this and vote on it.
Okay. We have a motion on the table.
Second.
I don't need a second, but is there further discussion on this motion? So just so that we're clear, that the motion would be to direct that the management analysis document includes two changes. One is the definitions. Again, correct me if I'm wrong. And the second is that one in the cells, when they talk about the terms protect, enhance, restore, that listed four fish, game, and wild.
So, Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure I understand. When you say this makes it a little stronger, can you kind of explain what you mean by that?
Reinforces the definition of the Constitution.
In what way?
With the definitions. The definitions, if we leave fish, game, and wildlife out of there, restore, enhance, protect, then it opens up, I think, a whole new area. Whether it be the ecological diversification balance, or are we really looking at the key areas that we defined early in the game, or protecting for fish, game, and wildlife? That's the clarification that we need to emphasize at every step of the way.
Further comments or questions?
I guess, Mr. Chair, Bob. I'm certainly comfortable and support that we continue to use the definitions of restore, protect, and enhance as we have defined them back in January, and that we continue to carry those forward in whatever document we have. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm not sure what
the recorder is on. No, we're going to get him back until 9.
And that's the only example I can think of where there should be a direct attack. No, I'm just saying you can't protect four of them.
Thank you. to call the meeting back to order after a short recess. We're going to try and get Scott patched in, and then Ellen, if you have questions.
Sure.
Scott?
I can hear you, Mike.
Great. We had a little diversion. It was a hot issue, or Ellen said a burning issue, and so we had a fire alarm go off, but we're all back in the business now, ready to start up again.
Hopefully this issue didn't blow up.
I'd like to make a comment on this motion when appropriate.
Okay. So Ellen and then Scott.
All right. Thank you. Well, Mr. Chair, I'm still trying to, I guess I don't have a clear explanation of why anyone wants less, why you want to do this, and I'm trying to understand how it would change things. And I'm thinking about forests and emerald ash forests as an example. Is this, if we said that you only can protect forests for the purpose of protecting fish, game, and wildlife, rather than just protecting forests, does that mean, for example, you couldn't try to fight a tree disease, even though if you save trees or if you save forests, you will protect habitat? Is that, I mean, give me an example of how this would affect that type of discussion. Would this prevent us from protecting forests, protecting wetlands? What would it change in what we can or cannot do?
I think if by not having the definition firm and tying it together to fish, game, and wildlife, we do have the potential to divert to different areas that are going to dilute our objective. And I think we had a good discussion with this yesterday with the LCCMR. And again, the emphasis was the positive of the LCCMR is to have diversity to move to change and up a wide range of things to do. We went into some detail as to has this been satisfying to the citizens of the state of Minnesota as far as thinking that they've gotten their money worth an accomplishment, and has that fund been directed properly? I don't know. There's a lot of discussion that it hasn't been applied properly. One of the things in the past history in the last 8-9 years has been the very firm definition of the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Conference, what that money was going to be spent for in the dedicated funding. And that definition took the constitutional dictate as far as the definition with the word only in there. And I think we can, by taking that word only out, we can create a very wide arena where we can spend the money, and we could think of all kinds of reasons to go in different directions. If we added the element of biological diversity and balance and replace them with fish, game, and wildlife, I think it opens it wide open to a major, major diversion of funds. And I don't think we're going to be able to focus on the target that we have to focus on, and that's exactly what we said in the constitutional language of enhancing, protect, restore, enhance wetlands, prairies, forests, and habitat for fish, game, and wildlife. And again, stating that the money in these areas is going to be for feed acquisition to be for that purpose. So I feel that by strengthening the resolve to put the words of the Constitution, which we have done, and the definitions in there, just keeps us better focused, better on track to put that crosshairs on the target and define where we're going to be going. And I think that affirms a strong opinion that's been expressed to us in the field by the many, many people that I've talked to. And I just think that we have to keep that language as firm and directed and focused as possible.
So, Mr. Chair, I guess what you're, I'm looking at the matrix and the language there. That's really what I'm focusing on, not so much the definitions, and I certainly understand the difference in the definitions. We've had a great deal of discussion about that. But you're sort of squishing the constitutional language together there and taking out some things. And so I'm trying to understand what that means. You're not any longer protecting forests because forests matter. You're not any longer protecting prairies or wetlands.
Oh,
you're just protecting
you know, the matrix is the matrix defining wetland, prairie, forest, and habitat has not changed. It's just the front portion of protect fish for fish, game, and wildlife. Now, we can protect the forests. We can have a major discussion of this against the invasion of emerald ash forests. Mm-hmm. Is this really the dictate that we should be looking at as far as being able to protect in that manner? I don't know.
So, Mr. Chair, I think what I hear you saying then is that we don't want to protect forests for any other purpose except for fish, game, and wildlife. We don't want to protect forests for other benefits that they provide, or protect prairies for other benefits or wetlands only for the purpose of, and to me it seems like you're narrowing the constitutional language too much. So I have a problem with that. But maybe I'm not understanding what you're saying, but that's how I read this.
And Mr. Chair, it's a matter of defining what is that measurement factor. We can look at different factors of analyzing how we protect it, but as the hunting and fishing community, if we protected the fish, game, and wildlife, the offshooting benefits are going to be there also. The synergism of what we do for the other species is automatically going to be included in there. It has to be. There's a synergism of what we do for fish, game, and wildlife, and the example of using that specifically, I think, is going to benefit the other species also. It's a matter of not diverting to try to spend the money on such a wide range of topics and wide range of protection and preservation that we don't concentrate on the initial measurement objective.
Scott, you had a question.
Well, I had a comment more than a question, Mr. Chair. The people that I've talked to, they certainly have an emphasis on habitat, and that habitat is to benefit game, fish, and wildlife. And I concur with Les that if we can articulate our emphasis on prairies, forests, wetlands, and habitat for the benefit of game, fish, and wildlife populations, I believe that that has merit, and I believe that the people that I talk to on a regular basis would adamantly support that. So I just wanted to voice my concurrence with Les's processes, and if I were there, I would vote for that amendment.
Thank you, Scott. Ellen.
Mr. Chair, just hopefully a final comment. So, for example, I'm just trying to follow up on what Les said. If there were some rare or significant plant species in a prairie or a wetland, those would not be worthy of protection under this scenario unless they somehow benefited fish, game, or wildlife. But just for the fact that they are plants, they're not beneficial to habitat per se, or they're not.
Well, do we want to include the prickly ash and the buckthorn and in the forest? Do we want to include the bullhead and the stickleback and the carp and the so you can see where we go if we start getting off the path of biological diversity. And biological diversity is something that we pretty much destroyed, and now we've got to pick it up. What is our species that we're going to be aiming at, and this is going to be species-specific in our measurement criteria. And if the deer and the ducks and the turkeys and the pheasants and the trout and the walleye in the northern are all protected, there's a major protection for the rest of those species. But if we concentrate on some subspecies, we may lose focus on what we originally intended to do.
Any further discussion on this motion?
I just still am having problems. I mean, I'm looking at the constitutional language that says the fund may be spent only to restore, protect, enhance wetlands, prairies, forests, and, in addition, habitat for fish, game, and wildlife. So I'm not understanding, I guess, something about why you're making the case that we need to do your amendment.
I'm saying let's carry that down to the matrix, and let's carry that down to the definitions.
That may be a misunderstanding your matrix.
Bob?
Mr. Chair, you know, we are in this discussion because Bill is presenting to us the approach that management analysis is using in the schedule and the invitees and all of the process that's there. And so I think we're trying to ensure that that is a process that is robust and inclusive and well-informed and well-understood by all the parties that participate and then those that read the outcomes of all of that work. So I guess I have a question maybe for Bill. Bill, is it your, maybe a couple questions, is it your understanding and expectation that management analysis at each of these sessions will make clear with the participants as to why they're there, what the constitution is behind their presence, and the law that relates to it?
Bill?
Yes.
Do you think that there's any, there'd be any doubt about that we have a constitution that, and do you expect that there will be some reference, if not direct, presentation of what the constitution says?
I think the constitution will be there.
So, Mr. Chairman, it seems to me that the only question that we've had as a council and with in our debates with the legislature about terminology has been on the definitions of restore, protect, and enhance. Mm-hmm. We as a council have a complete agreement through the work that we did in January and the document that we adopted for our procedures. We've learned that there are some legislators that have different views of that, but that has been supported on the House and Senate floors as to these terms that still apply. So I guess my view is that because that is the only area that has been of question, what is the definition of restore, protect, and enhance, I'm fully in favor of making sure that in the management analysis process it is understood by the participants that these are the terms and this is what they mean. And beyond that, I'm not sure that there's anything more would be needed.
Okay. Any further discussion on the motion? Hearing none.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. We have further discussion.
I think if I understand what Bob was saying, maybe we should divide this.
Thank you.
Because I'm in agreement with you, Bob, that I think the definition section, that has been approved by the legislature and the council in its, you know, in the final of the legislative session. It was approved by the legislature, and so I'm comfortable with that as well. I'm not comfortable with what the explanation is for changing the matrix. I'd like to vote on those separately and divide the motion.
Exactly. Well, we must be clear, Mr. Chair. I was just saying that it's because there has been, in the minds of some people, differences of definitions. We want to be sure that all the parties that come to these events know exactly what we mean, and this is specifically on those three terms.
So, Les, would you be willing to split that motion into the two definitions that Alan suggested?
Yes, and I think we need a continuity of the definitions from the Constitution to the matrix to the final definition in itself. And I think by maintaining that continuity, I would like to see the amendment stand as is, and yes, we can vote on it separately.
Okay. So we're going to split the motion into two parts. The first part is the matrix part to include those four fish, game, and wildlife under protect, enhance, and restore. So the upper part of the page. Is there any further discussion on that motion? Everyone is clear about what we're voting on.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Could I ask what line of orders to make? Is the proxy only for the voting of the officers?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, about
yeah. Any further discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor of the first motion, which would be to include the words fish, game, and wildlife in the matrices, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay, the motion does not carry.
Roll call.
Okay, roll call has been requested. Bill?
Mr. Chair, I think the correct motion, after you've already taken the vote, you could ask for a show of hands, a division, but not a roll call after the vote's already been called.
Request for roll call
and
be
prior to
the vote.
Okay.
So, that we're asking
so is there a request for a division?
Division.
Okay, so all those in favor of the motion, please raise your hand. Okay, and all those opposed, please raise your hand. Okay, so the motion does not carry. The second part of the motion is to adopt the definitions in our MAD documents. I'm sorry, the count was 3 in favor, 4 against. Okay, any further discussion on the second motion, which is the definitions? Hearing none. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Bob.
Yeah, just to make this final point, we are here in the great city of Grand Rapids, and there are probably a lot of folks in this audience that are here as well, so I just want to make sure that they all understand that on August 11th at the Forest History Center, from, is it 9:30 to 4, I think?
Yes.
Management analysis will be having this meeting, and there's another one in Detroit Lakes on the 17th, so if you happen to be from that area and are interested in this, please attend.
Mr. Chair, and going back, and also on the meetings, you mentioned the invitations will go out probably tomorrow?
Monday.
Soon, Monday, okay, sorry, and soon. And is it kind of by invitation only? If people do, and I see there's some other suggested invitees, and you've taken suggestions from council members. I hadn't really offered suggestions yet, but I may want to add some. Is it possible to add more people? And if people come who are not officially invited, is there only certain people? Are there only certain people who will be able to participate,
Bill.
Those who are invited?
There are two parts to the day's meeting.
Okay.
The first part is for the invited conservation professionals. The second part is for anybody who wants to provide input and comment on what the council ought to do, especially with regard to what the conservation professionals concluded was the right stuff.
And Mr. Chair, that point is, and these are all open.
They're all,
open. The public can attend all of them.
Yes. And they're all noticed on our website, so if anyone who wants more information can go to our website. Okay, any further discussion on item 9? If not, I'm hearing none. I'd like to move on to our next agenda item, which is our election of officers. And if you recall, members, when we adopted our operating procedures, we indicated that we would have our first slate of officers formally elected for 1 year, and then ending in this past June, our election of officers would occur this June, and then every June of every even numbered year. Well, we're in July, so this next slate of officers would be good for 1 year, and then the next slate a year from now would be good for 2 years, and forever after there'd be 2 year terms. So with that, I'm going to pass the gavel over to Ellen, who is going to chair this part of the meeting.
Okay,
how do I do? Well, we've got nominations. The procedure is that you can send nominations into the to the staff,
okay.
Or we can have nominations here at the meeting. And I did receive nominations, and if you want to take that.
I can read them.
Yeah, I think so.
I'll read the nominees that we have to date and then see if there are any other nominations. So the positions that we have available, or the officer positions that we have to vote on, are for chair, vice chair, secretary, treasurer, and legislative representative. And the nomination by Bob Schroeder is for as follows: Mike Kilgore, chair; Jim Cox, vice chair; Darby Nelson, secretary; David Hartwell, treasurer; Rick Hansen, legislative representative. And I believe that's the current slate that is currently in office. And Les Bench has nominated Bill Ingebrigtsen as legislative representative. Now, I should ask now if there are any other nominations. I believe we could take them now. Yes. So are there any other nominations? You're supposed to ask 3 times at a political event. So are there any other nominations? Are there any other nominations? So I don't know what Robert's rule says. Hearing no other nominations, nominations are closed. So we could decide that for those that are non-contested, we could have a motion for the slate that's non-contested position. So I would entertain a motion. Bob moves the nominations, we have a slate for chair, Mike Kilgore, Jim Cox for vice chair, Darby Nelson for secretary, and David Hartwell for treasurer. Is there any discussion on that slate? we should discuss who has proxies, who's represented with proxies.
Can I just ask Ellen?
Mike.
Scott called me, and he's on the phone, and he has a proxy for the votes, but he asked that before a vote's taken, if there's any change, that we could recess just for a minute or two if he needs to change his vote. Scott, right now, as you heard, at least for the first four positions, chair, vice chair, secretary, treasurer, there's just a slate of nominations. There's no contest to those. Can we proceed as you had suggested, or would you like us to recess for a couple minutes on those four?
On that slate, no recess request.
Thank you.
All right. So we have, I know we have proxies for Rick Hansen and Scott. We have your proxy. Or you're...
Yes, it's, I have Scott's...
You have Scott's...
Scott Rawls, and I've got James Cox.
Okay.
And I have Dave Hartwell.
Okay.
And Senator Anderson has Representative Hansen.
That's right. So we have four people represented through proxy vote today. Okay. So let's... If there's no, is there any further discussion on the motion to approve the slate as listed?
Madam Chair.
Bob.
Are we required to vote... In any stage of this budget, secret ballots.
Yes, we are.
Okay.
However, I think the motion is on.
Right. To suspend that. That's a rule. That's a bylaw, or
it's
that is what?
Operating procedure.
All right. We could accept a motion to do this by voice vote. I don't know what the.
So perhaps, Madam Chair, I can amend my motion. Madam Chair, amend my motion to allow for a non-secret voting of the slate that I've put forward.
Okay, on that, we'll accept that. You can incorporate that into your motion.
Thank you.
So on Bob's motion, does everyone understand the motion in front of us then? And then we will have a voice vote, so we'll proceed to the vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. All right, we have four officers elected, and this is for a one-year term for the remainder of the biennium, I guess. Then the last position for which we need to take a vote is for legislative representative. We have two candidates, and we should do a written ballot on that. Now, Scott, did you want to have a brief recess to have discussion about that?
With that slate of nominees, no recess is requested.
Okay. All right. Is there any other discussion before we pass out the ballots?
Yes, Madam Chair, just to make a couple points. I had made the nomination of Rick Hansen as the legislative representative, and I just want to be clear for the record that it has no reflection whatsoever on Senator Ingebrigtsen, who is a good and decent senator and a member of this council, and we're grateful for his participation. I make the motion on the basis of the duties of that legislative representative as I understand them and have discussed with Representative Hansen, which are, frankly, simply to approve the travel expenses of the council. It's my understanding that the Legislative Coordinating Commission, which actually will reimburse members, is led by the majority party. Members of the majority party, the minority members are participants as well. And that it is, it's my understanding that it's the preference of the Legislative Coordinating Commission that a member of the majority party also be the legislative representative of the council also be a member of the majority party. So it's on the basis of that understanding of both the duties and the preference of the Legislative Coordinating Commission that I make that nomination of Representative Hansen as the legislative representative.
And I would add to that, as Bob said, that Rick has been is the designee appointed by the Speaker of the House to serve in the finance chair's position on the council, and the Speaker of the House chairs the Legislative Coordinating Commission. And so I do believe that it would be appropriate to have her designee to serve in this capacity, and I also mean that with no disrespect to my colleague and enthusiastic council member, Senator Ingebrigtsen, whose name I can now pronounce successfully. It took me a while. Any other discussion? If not, let's pass out the ballots, please. Thank you.
receive one ballot for each of the boxes and yourself.
Senator Anderson?
Scott.
While they are taking the ballot vote, I would like to take an opportunity to thank the chair and the council members for allowing me to participate today via telephone. I'm having a difficult time hearing all of the commentary, so at the conclusion of the voting, I will be hanging up, but I wanted to take a moment and thank you for allowing me to participate in that fashion.
Well, Scott, we want to thank you for participating, and we understand it's not an easy time for you and your family. We really appreciate that you have taken the time to be with us, and sorry it's been a little hard to hear, but thank you so much for making the time to be with us today.
Thank you as well.
If I could just say one thing, Scott, we wish you the best of luck and Godspeed with the problems. I hope everything comes out okay.
That means a lot to me. Thank you, Les.
Thank you, Les.
Tallying the votes here, the new legislative representative is Bill Ingebrigtsen, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
All right, we have a new legislative representative, Senator Ingebrigtsen, and I want to congratulate and thank all the officers who have put in many, many extra hours and really have been dedicated to the work of the council. And with that, I'll turn it over to you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay, so our last item on the agenda, as we do at every meeting, is we welcome, and this is a great opportunity, and it's great to see so many people here at the council. We have a time now for public comments. We're constantly seeking input, ideas, perspectives from individuals, organizations. We don't get out of state that often, and here's a great time to be in northern Minnesota to hear perspectives on the Outdoor Heritage Fund and the work of the council. There was a sign-up sheet. Bill, can you help us? Do we have any names of people who would like to provide comments?
We have lunches here, too.
Okay, if we're council members.
And guests who are presenting.
Okay.
Put the two together.
Okay, and we're running a little bit late, so I guess what I would suggest is we would like to start the public comment period. If members, are you okay grabbing a box lunch at this time, or do you want to... Would you like to wait? Do you have a preference?
I'd like to wait. I'd be glad to wait.
Okay. So, well, why don't you, we have three individuals who have indicated they want to provide comments. Others certainly can, but we at least have three that have stated they'd like to do so.
Yes. Sure. Yes. What is your name?
Dale
Bennis. Dale?
Yes.
B-E-N-N-I-S-S?
B-E-N-N-I-S-S.
The three I have... plus Mr. Bennis are Dennis Good, David Holmbeck, and Craig Holla. Then we'll take them in the order in which I was contacted. Dennis Good, are you in the audience?
Could we see our time today?
Yes.
Okay. I'd like to do that.
Dave, would you please state your full name for the record?
Yes. David G. Holmbeck, Grand Rapids, Minnesota.
There's also a letter from Dennis Good on the back of it.
Thank you, council members, for giving me the opportunity to present my three recommendations to the Lazard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council. They are listed on the last page. One, LSOHC needs a guidance document that clearly defines by rule the definitions for restorations and degradation. And so I believe this is very germane to your discussion earlier. Number two, require all projects to have public participation and general support. Three, require all projects to have internal and external peer review. I'll skip my brief resume, which is in the first paragraph. I want to focus my testimony on one topic entitled Stream Restoration versus Habitat Improvement. It's more than semantics. In my opinion, Minnesota DNR Fisheries Dark River, St. Louis County Restoration Project is the epitome of the type of project and project process you should not fund. A June 29, 2009 news release of the Duluth News Tribune reported that Trout Unlimited, TU, will receive $2 million from LSOHC to restore Coldwater rivers and streams. To me, this is a very noble effort, but could be more difficult than one thinks. I have no axe to grind with TU. Although not a TU member, my wife and I like to fish trout and each buy a trout stamp every year. However, restoring Coldwater streams is much more difficult to attain than doing habitat improvement for more trout. The bar is much higher for restoration. I want the LSOHC and the taxpaying public to better understand the differences between habitat restoration and habitat improvement before they fund projects. Below are some general definitions of three levels of ecological repair in descending order of difficulties. Restoration, returning an ecosystem to its original, sometimes pre-settlement condition, or restoring lost functions. Rehabilitation, returning certain functions of an ecosystem to a previous state, but not to the original condition. Reclamation, returning certain functions of an ecosystem to a useful state, but not to the original condition. An example would be the reclamation of the mine land areas along Iron Range cities. All three levels of ecological repair assume some degree of natural resource degradation has occurred. The following is a definition of degraded habitat. Habitat that provides decreased functional value because of human activities, with observable, defensible, and measurable impairments. I believe there can be a big difference between a habitat restoration project and habitat improvement project. Restoration is a watershed-wide approach, managing the whole ecosystem, whereas habitat improvement is managing for a product. Restoration is working with the whole ecosystem and resulting in more species diversity, whereas habitat improvement strives for more of a single species, like brook trout, and results in less species diversity. Page two. I want to point out, however, that I'm not opposed to habitat improvement for single species management, and that it serves an important role in natural resource management. For example, logging benefits deer and grouse, sometimes at the expense of other more diverse species, but we normally don't say we are going to restore the forest by cutting it. We improve habitat for fewer species, that is, deer and grouse, by cutting the forest. We use deer grouse dedicated hunter license money to manage primarily for deer and grouse, or trout stamp money for trout habitat, and that is good natural resource management. These are examples of habitat improvement, not necessarily habitat restoration. I want to refocus my comments at Minnesota DNR's Dark River Project, St. Louis County, and why I feel similar projects and their processes should not be funded by LSOHC. In 2003, DNR asked Minnesota legislature for $225,000 to restore the Dark River. During the 2006-2009 Environmental Assessment Worksheet, EAW process, the Dark River Restoration Project was described by the agency as a restoration of a river with accompanying degraded conditions. However, the DNR did not provide supporting data to show degradation, held no public meeting to allow questions about their data, and provided no opportunity for outside peer review of their restoration project. This is inconsistent with DNR 2007 Stream Restoration Prioritization Criteria that requires community support / acceptance as per criterion number 5. Attached, find the 2008 Game and Fish Oversight Spending Report. In this report, the Dark River Project on that single page I attached They call it the Habitat Improvement Project. I wonder why, between 2006 and 2008, DNR changed their definition from restoration project to Habitat Improvement Project, since I believe there is a significant difference between habitat restoration and habitat improvement. It's more than semantics. In my opinion, it's easier getting funding when you call a project restoration. But is it truly restoration? During the EAW process, DNR alleged the Dark River is degraded because the river is sediment laden and too wide and shallow. DNR's use of Dr. Dave Rogers' universal channel typing to describe degree of degradation has had no external peer review, and the broader scientific community has not embraced Rogers' channel form paradigm. For example, stream geomorphologists from the National Center for Earth Surface Dynamics, INSED, headquartered at St. Anthony College, Minneapolis, including other academia and UNM scientists, have said Rogers' universal channel typing methodology is not well supported scientifically and inadequate for describing stream stability. DNR's definition of restoration for the Dark River Project has been to relax human constraints. That's their definition for this project. This, according to the 2008 Corps of Engineers Public Notice 2006-0440, where it's quoted, DNR defines restoration as the act of relaxing human constraints on the development of natural patterns of diversity. I believe DNR's definition of relaxing human constraints is too vague. It requires very little accountability by those attempting a restoration project under their definition. This definition is too arbitrary and capricious for projects funded by tax-paying citizens. Conditions and standards for LSOHC project funding need to be less arbitrary. Page 3. For LSOHC funding, I feel that all definitions of restorations and degradation should be defined by statutory rule, not some obscure, nebulous definition that leaves too much wiggle room to verify and held accountable for. For example, the Wetland Conservation Act clearly defines degraded wetlands and wetland restoration in Minnesota Rules Chapter 8420, subparts shown there. In addition, the PCA has water quality rules under Minnesota Rules Chapter 7050-0150 with subparts that define the physical, chemical, and biological degradation of a water body. The purpose of the rules is to better quantify and legally define wetland and water quality degradation. For federal agency, restoration is defined in the Federal Mitigation Regulations 33 CFR, or Code of Federal Regulations 332.2. I feel that LSOHC should adopt a policy that uses clearly defined statutory rules when funding valid restoration projects. Attached. I have a picture here of a culvert that I took in 2006. Attached by a picture of a severe erosion and poor culvert placement by Minnesota DNR in a designated trout stream and tributary to the Dark River. The DNR has not acknowledged this damage and other ecological damages we citizens identified during the EAW process. The only adverse impact identified in the Dark River EAW was that an increase in brook trout numbers could displace other associated species. This is habitat improvement, not restoration. My experiences have taught me that almost all habitat projects come with some degree of adverse impacts to other habitats, that is, resource trade-offs. Because LSOHC is funded by a wide cross-section of tax-paying people, not user group only, like the dedicated Game and Fish Fund through angler license sales, I feel the LSOHC is responsible to a much broader people group, even people who love beaver. Do you know that from 1999 to 2007, the DNR contracted with the U.S. Department of Ag, Wildlife Service, WS, trappers on the Dark River and trapped 129 beaver at a cost to them of $150 a beaver? I asked, what damages did the beaver cause that required expensive federal government trappers? All in the name of stream restoration? Did the U.S. government trapping result in significant improvement, such as trout to the creel? How many additional trout have Minnesota anglers taken on the Dark River because of Wildlife Service beaver trapping? In closing, I'd like to repeat my suggestions to you for a better LSOHC project funding policy. One, LSOHC needs a guidance document that clearly defines by rule the definitions for restorations and degradation, and you can add to that if you want. Two, require all projects to have a public participation and general support, something the Dark River project did not do. Three, require all projects have internal agency and external agency peer review. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Holmes. Craig Halla.
Mr. Chair, I would like a question.
Absolutely.
Yeah, sure. In a nutshell.
In a nutshell.
The culvert is bad. Is the Beaver, is it an improvement to the habitat on Dark River, or is it a degradation?
There's nobody from the DNR to defend themselves here, sir, but the point is, they called it a restoration project, and if you use the strict term of restoration where you have diversity of species, then there was an expense of the Beaver for trout. It should have been a habitat improvement project then. Secondly, I know that area very well. I grew up in that area. To trap Beaver, there has to be some kind of groundwater input. So the Beaver are there, they allege, because it's warming the stream, okay? But unless there's groundwater input, the stream won't cool anything. And we don't believe there's sufficient groundwater input to cool that water down. Secondly, there's a perpetual supply of forage. There's alder and willow that's been there for hundreds of years. They allege it's been due to land use change, forestry practice. But it's an entitled terrain that's a perpetual Beaver supply. I mean, Beaver, you can never control that. So I wish I could spend more time with that.
Thank you. Craig?
That this is on Potlatch land, they only have a legal easement to go across many acres of Potlatch land, so why are they doing it anyway?
Great, thank you. Craig, welcome.
I'll be brief. I appreciate the opportunity to meet and address the council. My name is Craig Halla. I'm the regional manager for Forest Capital Partners. We are officed out of International Falls, Minnesota. We manage 300,000 acres up primarily in Cooch, Itasca, and St. Louis County, a little bit in Lake of the Woods County, but not very much. Company-wise, Forest Capital owns 2.2 million acres throughout the country, here in Minnesota, Washington, Oregon, Louisiana, and Idaho. We have no manufacturing facilities, so basically we are just a land and timber company. Forest Capital Partners is very committed to conservation. We're very committed to sustainable forestry. All of our properties are SFI, or Sustainable Forest Initiative certified. Showing our commitment to conservation here in Minnesota, in 2007 we closed a conservation easement on 51,000 acres up in northern Itasca, southern Cooch. We're currently working with the DNR, Craig Engwald and Dick Peterson, on an additional 76,000 acres. The easement language has been wrote. We're just waiting for the appraisal to come through and take a look at the appraisal. It's in the Federal Appraisal Reviewer's desk right now. We've also started initial talks with the Nature Conservancy and the state on Phase 4, Forest Capital Phase 4. That is approximately about 14,000 acres, and that lies right around our Phase 1 in Itasca County. Showing our commitment as a company for conservation easements, we have an easement underway on the Oregon coast to protect marbled murrelet habitat. It's a shore bird that nests in Doug Fir. We also have a project in northern Idaho in critical grizzly habitat. So our company is very committed to conservation and conservation easements. Here in Minnesota, we have lots of opportunities remaining on Forest Capital land. We have properties along the Rainy River, Little Fork, Big Fork watersheds. We have properties along the south shore of Black Bay of Rainy Lake that is bordered by three sites by the Voyageurs National Park. We have properties around the Little Lakes in St. Louis County and the Ash River drainage. So we're very excited about the Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment and the prospects of what it may mean to forest capital and the state in the future. This council showed its support for conservation easements with the Blandon UPM Kimney easement, and we're happy to see that. However, we have increasing challenges. As a timber investment company, that's what TIMO stands for, we have investors to show a rate of return. And with falling timber prices and increasing property taxes, it's increasingly putting pressure on us to increase our land sales program. It's no secret that in our business that it's 3 to 5 to maybe even more times profitable selling land than managing long term for timber. And that for a forester is not good news. So we're hopeful that the conservation easements may lend us an alternative to increasing these land sales, and we're hoping with the support of the council we can go down that road. The last item that I would like to mention that further reduces for us here in Minnesota the ability to manage for timber long term and to keep our land open to the public is the governor's recent decision to cap the SFIA, or the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act. That act was started in 2001, I believe, and 100% of our lands are open to the public currently. We have about 110 miles of summer road that are accessible and open to the public. We have approximately 60 to 70 miles of snowmobile trails open to the public. We have countless ATV trails and countless opportunities for hiking and biking on our property currently. We are paid not a penny for that. The SFIA, or the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act, was really paying that bill. With the capping, with the governor's decision to unallot that money and to cap that, it puts serious jeopardy into all of the above. And in closing, I would just like to state that we at Forest Capital are definitely a willing seller of conservation and conservation easements, and it is our hope that this council and the state of Minnesota will be a willing buyer. Thank you.
Thank you. Dale Bennis.
Mr. Chair, just a brief comment.
Go ahead.
For the Forest Capital individual, as speaking outside of the heart, was hard on your Heritage Council as a private citizen who just acquired property on the Ash River Trail. The no hunting signs will not go up. We do not like to see the fragmentation, and the no hunting signs go up. We will just like the blocking on it. And I personally support, we've got the Cavendish Trail running right through the property, and we very much support the activities of Open Access. I personally will be working on that along with the trail.
You currently use our property then?
Absolutely.
You're a testimonial then. So are thousands other in northern Minnesota.
Okay. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Dale Finish. I'm a supervisor for Spain Township, which is about 12 miles south here. We have a very unique problem. This is on the Blandon UPM Conservancy. We're having some serious problems with this agreement. And we are a small township. We basically have, 120, 130 people living in our township.
We have 51 square miles in our township, and Blandon's owns 40 square miles. With that, going into this conservancy, we, our Spang's future is reliant on a tax base of its property. Now, I understand that the taxes are done here in Itasca County, but what happens is we are expecting more traffic. We're going to have more traffic on our roads. We just have dirt roads. We have more wear and tear, more maintenance. We need some kind of help maintaining these roads, which we are not going to get from the county. I had discussions with Mr. Engel, and these guys here, and we just can't get anything said. And I need help from this council, because this council is financing this project. My people in our township, we need some financial help, something to back us up. We're just a small community. Most of our people are old, retiring. We're looking at, for example, let's use the 40 square miles of land. The value on that land, when you no longer can sell it, you cannot break it up, the value of that land will drop. All right? So we are expecting a lower tax base coming off that property. Second of all, the property that we own, the people that live there that butt up against this property, we expect that property to rise in value, because people are going to want to eventually live someplace where they can walk out their back door for 40 square miles and not touch anything. Again, we have, most of our people are elderly, retired. We don't want them taxed off their property either. So I don't know what the answer to this is. All I know is this is our last resource to get some kind of help for the people in our township. It's just not our township. We do have 40 square miles, but there's several townships around here that have the same concern. They may not have as much land, but they do have the same concern. So, I've actually emailed, I believe, all you guys. At one time, one person called me back, and I'm sorry, I don't remember which one that was, but I don't know what else to say. Thank you for
Thank you.
Just a quick question, Mr. Chair. 2 weeks ago, I was up talking to the Northeast County Commissioners, and I made the mistake of mixing up tilt with no net gain, and was corrected quite severely on it. And one of the problems, we listened to the problem, and I don't know that it's a problem that this council can even touch, but as a local government unit, the county is going to have to look at a taxation assessment to the KLM properties to be able to get the money, the tax money, justifiably due for the maintenance of those roads. And I think it becomes a county assessment objective to do that. And if the statutory law doesn't allow that, I think the county commissioner is going to have to force the legislators that are involved in that to change the statutory law to give that county the authority to assess tax so you can get the funds necessary to maintain your roads.
All right.
Great.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Next on the agenda, Mr. Chair, is a presentation that Tom Cooper has coordinated. And Tom?
Do you have access to power?
There's a projector here, so I'm assuming.
I'm going to suggest now maybe you can find the break for lunch.
Perfect. Well, tell you what, let's break for lunch and we will reconvene and have a presentation as the agenda says starting at 1 o'clock. So thank you.
Amazing.
No.
No doubt.
I'm going to have to talk to make it clear.
ago, I was invited to a meeting after St. Cloud. A number of you who are here today were at that meeting where the discussion was on young forests and wildlife and things of that sort. And Tom Cooper from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service presented at that meeting, and I was quite impressed with what I thought was the multi-species approach and things like that with this young forest and wildlife presentation held for those who lost it on the trip. So we've invited Tom to come up and provide that presentation to us. Afterwards, we're heading out to see some examples of young forest being managed for a young age, as well as general forest management. So with that, I'll turn it over to you, Tom.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks to the council for having me come and provide this presentation today. And what I'm going to do is start off is talking a little bit about the habitat needs of young forest wildlife and some species that are relying on this and current threat facing populations for these species. I'm going to focus on the American woodcock, the golden-winged warbler, and the ruffed grouse. And then towards the end, I'm going to talk about an initiative that was started around the woodcock, but will also be beneficial to a lot of other species of young forest wildlife. And once I'm done with the presentation, Steve Wiles, who's the guy from the Fish and Wildlife Service, is going to provide some updates on some work he's currently working on, managing and creating habitat for young forest wildlife. Dane Metzger with the Rock Trout Society is going to talk. And then Norm Moody's going to give his perspective, being a longtime land manager in northern Minnesota, on management for these species. That gets started. Here's a graph or a figure showing the key habitat components required by American woodcock, in essence also grouse. Looking at the age of forest, early on, American woodcock need open areas for, that's where they do their courtship display or their singing grounds, and they also use these areas for nighttime roosting habitat. And they can be, these openings can be sites where recent clear cuts have occurred, or pastures or fields bordering forested areas. The next stage of habitat required by American woodcock is real young, free-sprouting forest habitat. And the key thing to keep in mind here is they're responding more to structure, not necessarily species of habitat. So primarily you think of it as young aspen habitat in northern Minnesota, but it could also be willow habitat, alder-type habitat. So that key is the structure is real dense vegetation and also moist soils, because woodcock probe into the ground primarily for invertebrates and worms being the primary food. So those are key components, that dense structure and also moist soils. And this good feeding habitat after a clear cut for about 20 years of age, and then into that 15 to 30 year age class, it's also important for nesting and brood rearing habitat. And historically, northern Minnesota had a lot of disturbances, fire, insect, wind events that would create this across the landscape. And more now, this habitat is created by commercial forestry practices, so better one. And then looking at golden-winged warblers, their habitat needs closely overlap with the needs of grouse and woodcock. Aspen clear cuts are important, alder swamps, shrub field habitats, utility right-of-ways, beaver wetlands, tamarack bogs, reclined strip mines, and also abandoned farms. So a lot of overlap in the needs, and there's a host of other species that require this habitat. And as many of you probably know, ruffed grouse provide a lot of recreational value in Minnesota. There's approximately 115,000 hunters a year that harvest about 545,000 birds a year, and this is the first in the nation. Minnesota is the highest harvest state in the nation. Looking at woodcock, there's over 12,000 hunters approximately a year that harvest a little bit over 33,000 birds. And based on some work that Ruffed Grouse Society has done, they estimate, a conservative estimate is that each grouse hunter spends about $500 a year pursuing their grouse hunting, and that computes to about $50 to $75 million a year towards the Minnesota economy that's generated by grouse hunters. That's a picture of my dog from a hunt this past year in Cass County. The big concern overall across the U.S. Groups that rely on young forest habitat, birds that rely on this habitat have been declining. looking at these graphs, birds requiring young forest shrub habitat, about 47% of them across the eastern U.S. are declining. 14% are showing increasing population trends, while 39% are a relatively stable population. And if you look at mature forest birds, about 31% are declining. There's still a good number of them that are declining, but 39% are showing increasing population trends, and 30% have relatively stable trends. And this information here is based on the North American Breeding Bird Survey that's conducted every year. Specifically looking at golden-winged warbler population trends, for the eastern U.S. it's been declining about 2.8% per year. The average is about 0.5 birds per route that's run when you put everything together on a regional basis. Then looking at in Minnesota, the average is about one bird per count within the forested part of the state. And important thing, Minnesota plays an important role in the future conservation of golden-winged warblers. About 42% of the global population nests within Minnesota, so it's a very important resource. And then looking at some modeling work that's been done for golden-winged warblers, you can see that yellows and oranges and reds in Minnesota, this is for Bird Conservation Region 12, which covers the northern part of Minnesota. Fairly important, high predicted abundance is based on current habitat conditions for golden-winged warblers in Minnesota. Looking at population trends for American woodcock, this information is based on American woodcock singing ground survey. Again, it's an annual survey that's conducted with many partners. Anybody here do any singing ground survey routes as part of the survey? Earl does. So thanks for all your help on that. Long term, within the central part of the central management region, which includes basically the upper Midwestern states into southern Canada, long-term declining trend since 1968, declining about 1.1% per year. However, similar to the golden-winged warbler, population trend in Minnesota has remained relatively stable. So it's very important also to the long-term conservation of woodcock. Minnesota plays an important role. And some modeling work that was done for woodcock also shows that pretty much overlaps with the important areas shown for golden-winged warblers, overlaps with the areas shown for American woodcock. Why are they doing relatively okay in Minnesota versus the rest of their ranges? Minnesota, as you can see from this graph, shows has about 70% increase in young forest habitat since 1985, where most other states have shown a significant decrease. So there's good habitat here. Because there's good habitat here, those populations have remained relatively stable. However, with this increase, you'd also expect some population growth if that were a limiting factor. So we've been working with the Minnesota DNR to identify some other areas that may be limiting populations within Minnesota. And then looking at the forest span site distribution past and present. In the early 1970s, there's about 8.6 million acres of timberland in Minnesota, compared to about 11.9 million acres of timberland in the early 2000s. And this is based on the Forest Service Forest Inventory Assessment data. And you can see in the early 70s, there's about 2.1 million acres of young forest habitat, small diameter habitat, and presently about 4.3 million acres. In the 1970s, that 2.1 million acres comprised about 24% of the forested landscape, and it comprises about 36% of the forested landscape now. Again, as the increase in this habitat, yet populations haven't continued to increase. So we need to start looking at, is this habitat, we may have a lot of it, but is it in the best location to be productive for woodcock? Because of the concern with declining woodcock populations, the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies created what was called the Woodcock Task Force to develop a conservation plan for woodcock. And the main objectives of the plan were first to halt the population decline by 2012, and then next to achieve positive population growth by 2022. And the third objective is to maintain the early forest young habitat that we have out there right now, and by 2022 to increase that. With the discussions in Minnesota here, with Cynthia Osmussen and others, probably not going to add additional young forest habitat in Minnesota, and as I mentioned before, we need to look at putting it in better places where there's moist soil with the right landscape composition of singing, roosting habitat, with feeding habitat, and nesting habitat. And the plan, and for anybody that's interested, is available on www.timberdoodle.org. If you're not familiar with American Woodcock, a lot of people call it Timberdoodles. It's a website that's dedicated to the various products associated with the development of the conservation plan. And then one more, looking at maintain the current young forest habitat we have in Minnesota for BCR 12, which is the northern part of the state. Again, there's about 4.3 million acres. Just to maintain that, we have to create approximately 215,000 acres of young habitat every year over the next 20 years to maintain that. And looking at BCR 23, which is the transition zone part of the state, there's about 400,000 acres of that habitat right now, and to maintain that over the next 20 years, we got to create close to 20,000 acres. To date, to begin implementing these goals from the conservation plan, regional initiatives were developed in the New England states. It's the Northern Forest Initiative. In the northern part of the Appalachians, it's the Appalachian Woodcock Initiative. And then in the Upper Great Lakes states, the Upper Great Lakes Woodcock and Young Forest Initiative. And six strategies for each of these initiatives were adopted to begin taking the goals, the habitat goals from the plan and putting them on the ground. The first is to develop BCR-specific best management practices for the establishment of young forest habitats. And that document, in the next slide I'll show, just finished that up, and that was a very rewarding experience. A lot of input from both game and non-game folks, state, federal, and local agencies as well into developing that BMP document. Next is to take what we think is good woodcock habitat and habitat for other species requiring young forest habitat and put it on the ground in demonstration areas. And then monitoring and evaluating, is it doing what we expect it to do? And for instance, with some of the demonstration areas, we'll be setting up new woodcock survey routes. We can compare what's happening on that local area with the larger landscape from the information that we get from the American Woodcock Singing Ground Survey. Next, we'll be monitoring them, creating case histories for each of these demonstration areas, and it'll be an adaptive process where we're learning from what we think is good, evaluating it, and making adjustments moving forward. And here's the document that just got completed. I have three copies of it here for folks that are interested. And the basic premise of the BMPs for this Woodcock Initiative in the Great Lakes states is to identify 500 to 1,000 acre management units, evaluate the current condition of that, and make sure that we have roosting, singing, diurnal feeding, and nesting, brood rearing habitat. The management unit should be centered on an area that provides some moist soil that we know will be moist all the time and provide feeding areas for woodcock. 80% of the unit should be dedicated to feeding, nesting, and brood rearing habitat. Each area should have one roosting field per 100 acres, and roosting fields are the ideal size, about 5 acres in size, and should have at least 8 singing grounds per 100 acres. And the main thing here is you need to consider the surrounding landscape when making management decisions. You may be in an area that has some clearings already, pastures, hay fields, so that may not be as important as creating feeding areas. So you have to really, it's a case-by-case basis of what's needed in each of these demonstration areas.
Is that on your website too?
It will be. Yep. And with that, we've had good cooperation among the three state Department of Natural Resources, Woodcock, Minnesota, the Rock Grouse Society, the Wildlife Management Institute, which I should note is kind of leading these initiatives, and who Steve Wilds is working for, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the Forest Service, and also the Golden Wing Warbler Working Group. And again, more information is available on the timberdoodle.org website. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Steve Wilds, who's working for Wildlife Management Institute on a contract basis. He's retired from the Fish and Wildlife Service, and he can talk about some of the projects that are proposed, and then also some funding opportunities that that the Lasard Council may be able to help us out with.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for letting us come in and visit with you for a few minutes today. As Tom mentioned, I am working for the Wildlife Management Institute now, and my job is to assist partners in creating, maintaining habitat for the Upper Great Lakes Woodcock and Young Forest Initiative. So I've been working with National Wildlife Refuges, the Chippewa National Forest, the Minnesota DNR, Woodcock, Minnesota, the Rook Grouse Society, Cass County Lands Department, over the last 10 months that I've been doing this, trying to figure out ways that we can put, not only put more, but maintain existing habitats on the landscape. Now, as Tom mentioned, Minnesota is one of the few states that still has a lot of early succession forest habitat, thanks primarily to the robust timber market of the last 10 or 15 years. That's declined in, now and, through the housing market changes, but there's still an opportunity to maintain young forest on the landscape. We're looking at ways to use biomass from the forest as an economic product that can benefit both local economies and wildlife that utilize these young forests. We don't think that the entire forest needs to be young. We want the entire continuum across the landscape. We want a good balance out there so that all of the species that are indigenous to Minnesota can find what they need in those forests. So it takes a balanced approach, and we need to think carefully through all of those things as we plan this. Unfortunately, I think that the public in general doesn't understand early succession forests very well. They don't understand the importance of it in the land forest landscape of the Great Lakes region. And so that's one of the parts that we're trying to convey is that these demonstration areas are being developed. One of the refuges that I've worked with a little bit is Minnesota Valley National Wildlife Refuge, which is right in the heart of the Twin Cities. Lots and lots of people go there. A wonderful opportunity to educate people about the values of young forest and the values of forest management in general. So my goal is to continue to work with the state and with other entities, counties, other organizations, and try to find ways that maybe not increase but maintain these young successional forests on the landscape. And it takes active forest management to do that. You have to have a lot of cutting going on. It's nice to see this young habitat, but recognize that it's going to change very rapidly, as Tom pointed out in one of the slides. Within about 20 years, it's of little use to woodcock. And so, and golden wing warblers, we're learning also through some studies done at the University of Minnesota and other schools around the country that many of these birds that are associated with old growth forests during the nesting and breeding period, when they fledge or leave the nest, they're going into these young forests because there's more security there and there's more food available to them. So we're trying to improve our knowledge in general relative to birds in the forest and trying to make sure that we're managing it in a way that provides that continuum throughout the forest that provides the habitat needs for these birds throughout the year. So anyway, that's a couple things that we're also doing is working with on the, trying to develop some commercial, non-commercial sites where we might do some shearing of decadent alder and willow, and we're going to be putting together some proposals for that sort of work over the next few months. And ultimately, we'll try to keep regenerating this habitat from over the long term. So that's all I wanted to present this morning. That was afternoon, I guess it is now. Tom, who's next?
Sandy, you want to talk about Jim, the work that RGS?
Yeah, in the interest of saving time, I want to save our comments until we get out in the field in just a few minutes, but take-home message is that in order to sustain, restore, enhance, protect, I'm not sure which definition we want to use or which word we should use, but in order to maintain a full array of forest wildlife in the landscape, you have to maintain a full array of forest wildlife habitats. Very young to very old. The only way we can make young habitats stay, and that's the fire, which did force historically, is through forest management. The nice thing is that because through forest management, we actually get paid to create quality wildlife habitat for many of these critters that are defining. So it's a true win-win. And as I said, we're going to talk later. Dan is with the Rough Grouse Society.
Thank you, Bill. And then finally, Norm Moody's going to provide comments. Norm recently retired as land manager for Cass County. One of the things he's going to talk a little bit about is the Forest Landscape Planning Committees, which are kind of a forest corollary to the Working Lands Initiative in the ag part of the state, which I'm sure that some of you are familiar with.
Thank you. I'm here on behalf of the Sheriff-Tailed Grouse Society, the Woodcock, Minnesota Prairie Chicken Society. Basically the whole gamut, and they're all interested in habitat. It all has to do with land. I do have an association with the Minnesota Forest Partnership Group, and they are very interested in what's going on in the landscape. And I eat, sleep, think about land asset management all the time, because that is your base resource. And I strongly support their planning, their initiative, and it's all about ownership patterns. It's about the resources. I heard, I'm going to pick up on some comments earlier. Somebody said, well, you don't restore the forest by harvesting it, cutting it, clipping it. Yes, you do. That's exactly what you do. Everybody gets excited about a 150-year-old red pine out there. Boy, that's really exciting. I go, how about that 2,000-year-old cone of aspen? That if you don't harvest it and you let it die, all that genetic material is gone. Quick note here. I'm going to throw names out in case you're out of your way. Bill Bird, the renewable plant biologist from the DNR, said Minnesota is the last bastion of the early successional forest, i.e. the aspen forest. As you saw earlier, we're losing it in other places. One of the things I did when I was on the Minnesota Forest Resource Council, I kept pushing for, let's find out what's really happening out there. Because people were coming in and saying, oh, we're overcutting the forest. Another group would come in and say, nope, we're undercutting the forest. And we always were talking about it. I said, why don't we just collect the data and see what's being harvested? We still collect the data in Cass County statewide and deliver it to the other people. It was, at the time, I think less than 1%, Mike, do you remember, is the harvest level, which means we weren't even keeping up to growth, not even coming close. So getting good data is important. Again, the early successional forests, these small clearcuts scattered around, they do provide for the greatest number of species and the greatest number of total individuals in the forest. People kind of forget that. They think, well, gee, we need some old growth out there. Actually, there is no old growth out there, but the bird species. Check with Jan Green on that. But yeah, we do need some old growth, but if you really want to provide the greatest number of species and the greatest number of individuals, make sure you've got a really good component of young, healthy forest. The other thing I think about now is I used to think about pulp, paper, and solvent. My mind has changed. I now think about pulp, paper, and sabo, and the economy there. There's something new that's on the horizon that's coming very fast. And that's, I look at that tree, or I can look at that alder, and I think, kilowatts or BTUs. How many people here know what the conversion is between coal and wood fiber in terms of BTUs? A ton of coal equals the same number of BTUs as a ton of wood. It's a real eye-opener. We're going to be putting in gasifiers at Deep Portage in the next 3 months. It's another opportunity for us to harvest these things. I'm going to wrap it up real quick here. Another one, since I did present in front of the Society Committee, the industrial forest land issue, that's probably one of the greatest issues out there. We need to preserve those industrial forest lands. Those are key components. We talked about ownership patterns. We do not want to lose those from the landscape. We do not want to lose those from the economy. I did hear the other individual talk about property taxes. That almost came out of my chair. One more on the tour asked me about property taxes. I spent the last 30 years, it's been that long. I think Les talked about county wildlife managers. It's the first time I heard anybody talk about county wildlife managers. I was the second county wildlife manager in the state, so I'm intimately familiar with the property tax issue. Just a quick example of the land ownership patterns and how they can be critical. I just thought with one page, we have several hundred acres. There's 450, 480 acres, give or take. Public land. Guess what? It's not public land because you can't get there. So you have that acreage. It belongs to you. You each have one undivided share in that parcel. But you can't get to it. It's difficult for us to manage it. That's part of this whole land assets issue that we discussed, is that LCCMR did provide us the money, so we do gain access to some of these. We'll look at buying a 40 like that. If that comes up for sale, but we'll talk to all the surrounding neighbors. Say if you're interested in selling, we'll buy. Because we want to get in there and manage that timber, get that early succession forest going. And eventually somebody cracks and we'll sell it to 40 or the 80 or the 160. If we don't need the land, it doesn't fit into our ownership, we'll just put the easement in so the public has access. And then sell the other land. But what it does is we see it in our revenue, so thank the economy and thank jobs. The minute it has public summer access, we're looking at anywhere from 10 to 25% increase in the value of wood off all of that land. So it's a real revenue source. The other issue on these public lands, and I'm a little supporter of the landing issue. When the timber prices took a dive, and that's when our forest industry most needed the stumpage, the private land went. It was off the market. But the public land, the state land, the industry land stepped right up and kept that wood flowing and kept those jobs and kept what mills we do have still with them. That's not crunchy timber for me. Let's go have a tour.
I'm going to ask for some help here because I don't want to be doing five things at once and doing them poorly. But I have actually, for Tom, I'm going to give you my picture. I put this myself on land this spring. A little woodcock chick. That was fun. Get you electronic copy sometimes. The help I need is passing out copies of some of the things. I see some people have them, because I email some of this up. I want to make sure the council members each have one. This is the tour map, the summary, and some site summaries that we're going to talk about out there. So, you guys, and then also we have one thing I'm just going to give you. It's a UPM product that was done in Finland, but it actually has Minnesota included here. UPM has the Global Biodiversity Initiative, and this is a key concept that you're going to hear about today on the tour. And Cheryl Adams is our forest ecologist. Normally she's the one who would be here giving the tour, but she's occupied otherwise today, so I'm the forest manager for Glenn. And I'm going to just tell you that if you get a copy of this, open it up to the center, you see the six components of the Biodiversity Initiative. And Cheryl Adams is on the next page, and there's some things about the USA that's on the plan of land. So take a look at that. And finally, there's a little brochure that has to do with forest recreation, and this is one of the conservation values, the access to the land for public recreation that has been purchased through the easement for the public's benefit in perpetuity. So I'll just leave that one on too. Now, I need two more helpers, real quickly. Let's put this map here first. You guys can help me hold it up. This is a map of the greater Grand Rapids area. I'm sorry if you're standing in front of people. Grand Rapids is right here. We're going to head down into this area. The yellow is the land that is protected under this easement. We're going to be around the Sugar Lake area and down into Shingle Mill Road and Smith Creek Road area this afternoon. The first stop for those who are driving, we're going to try to caravan out there, but if you get separated and get lost, the first stop is not number one, it's number six. We're going to do this in reverse order so the van ends up further south when we're done. And that first stop is going to be right at the corner of County Road 449 and 17, which is up just north and east of Sugar Lake. It's near the Rutgers Resort area. So we're going to probably head out going west out of town on Highway 2 and down County Road 63, and then we're going to get on to 17 and come down to that intersection. So that's where you want to end up in a few minutes when we depart. So the other point about this map is the conservation easement is covering the UPM lands that are dark yellow here. The light yellow is county lands. State lands are the light green. Federal is this brownish color. You can see that we are well mingled with all those public lands. So that's a point. If you haven't seen that map before, that's important. Okay, guys. And we'll do just one more. This is about a 5 second map. I just want to make the point that one of the values that people maybe don't catch when we talk about the public interest being served well in these conservation easements, one of the things that can be easily lost if you don't protect the land the way that we did with the easement is these public recreation corridors. We have the green lines on this map are our forestry roads, which by definition in the conservation easement will be open for public use. Much of the season wide open for highway vehicles. We do reserve the right to close them seasonally to protect them. We also have snowmobile trails shown in the dark blue, and those are critical pathways. If those were sold off and people put up no trespassing signs, you wouldn't have a snowmobile trail anymore. And then there is a dark purple one, which is a new ATV trail. I think it's gone through the environmental review. It's about to start construction, and that's an emerging thing. So planning UTM lands are key for that in this area. So thanks, guys.
So we can roll it up. I think when you ask there's a question or two, we can head off.
We'll head off, John. But after years of working for DNR and trying to do meetings and being out and trying to be sensitive to the public, I think we all have to say thank you to the council for taking the time. You had a meeting to take off last night. You're off to a field trip now. Your faith is enormous. And as a Minnesotan, I want to thank you and say how proud I am of watching you people. It's fun here to watch smart, divergent, intelligent, articulate people discuss difficult projects and try to come up with the best answer for all of us. And I personally thank you, and I think we as Minnesotans owe you and your volunteer efforts an enormous gratitude. So thank you for coming up here.
Thank you.
Okay. So we're going to assemble in a caravan up front, right off this parking lot.
You're in the lead, Jim, and you're in it.
Trailblazer.
Did you feel good about it?
Well, you know.